Good Monday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Fueled as always by Hornady and coming to you, as we do most every day from beautiful Farmville, Virginia, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you've joined us today. Have a great show for you on the program here in about 20 minutes or so. Selena Zito going to join us from Sirius XM POTUS 124. When we last spoke with Selena, she was on her way to Winchester, Virginia. And her column now about the Virginia governor's race is out. Democrats, she says, should be terrified by this governor's race. And you know, it's really interesting. The last few polls, most of the last few polls, have had this race within the margin of error. I think there was one poll that had Ralph Northam with a fairly substantial lead. And yet, I don't hear a great deal of confidence from the left. I don't hear a great deal of confidence from the right either. I think most of the people who are politically aware in this state and are politically connected in this state are kind of unsure what the turnout's going to be. Typically, an off-year election like what we have in Virginia going to give you a much lower turnout than even a midterm election model like we'll see next year. So that's generally speaking a matter of bringing out your base. And I just don't know that Democrats feel like they are really getting their base out there. So Selena was in Winchester, Virginia, which is, it's Northern Virginia, but it's not Northern Virginia, D.C. suburbs. It's closer towards where West Virginia and Virginia and Maryland all meet. And it's a town that has been growing because it is a town that has attracted retirees from around the country. It's become this sort of retirement mecca. A lot of seniors drawn by the great health care there in the region. So Selena goes out to Winchester, Virginia, and she meets this couple, Darren Johnson and his wife. She says they were tireless volunteers for Hillary Clinton last year. They knocked on doors. They made phone calls. She says they were invested. When she lost, the couple was devastated. Now, Darren Johnson doesn't even know who's running for governor. He said, I've voted every year for the past 46 years, always informed, always enthusiastic, always involved in the process. Now it's really hard to care. Huh. And see, that's the stuff that has Democrats worried. As Selena writes, Ralph Northam should have a comfortable lead right now. Terry McAuliffe, the outgoing governor he currently serves under, she says, is popular and generally seen as successful. Plus, she says, Virginians have historically elected governors from the party opposite to a president who has won the year before. So a Republican wins the White House, a Democrat wins the governorship in Virginia. She says Mark Warner won, a Democrat won in 2001, the year after George Bush took office. Bob McDonnell, a Republican, won in 2009, the year after Barack Obama took office. But she says Northam's numbers aren't up. She says, in fact, the last three public polls show next month's race within the margin of error. Both parties, she says, have pulled out all the stops. Barack Obama was in town. George W. Bush was here for a fundraiser. Joe Biden, she says, has been to Virginia. So has Vice President Mike Pence. And it still seems like this race is very much up in the air. So we're going to talk about this with Selena Zito coming up here in about 15 minutes or so. Steve Holbrook, also later in the hour, Second Amendment attorney and scholar on the 17 all-Democrat attorney generals who have signed a letter to Congress. Now, typically, when we talk about what attorneys generals are doing or attorneys general are doing, they're filing amicus briefs, friends of the court briefs. We just saw a friend of the court brief filed by several anti-gun attorneys general out in the Ninth Circuit, seeking to not only uphold but to enact California's ban on magazines over 10 rounds. This is not an amicus brief. They're not writing to the court. They're writing to Congress. And they're saying, don't pass national right to carry reciprocity. We, these attorneys general, don't want it. including, by the way, since there are 17 attorneys general, that means that there are several attorneys general in states that have shall-issue concealed carry laws on the books that are basically saying, you know what, we trust our residents to lawfully carry here at home, but we don't think you should trust them when they leave the state. When they leave the state, holy moly, watch out. Because, you know, I mean, you just really can't trust these people. So we'll talk about this with Steve Holbrook coming up later on in the hour. In hour two, Jazz Shaw of Hot Air with a rather depressing story, one that is not unusual. You probably find a story like this almost every day. How the mob shut down a Massachusetts coffee shop over anti-police sentiments. Now, again, you can find a story every day of somebody who says, a business owner in particular, who says something stupid on social media. Not, usually not on their own personal account, usually on the account associated with their business. And invariably, a howling mob will ensue from one side or the other. What's a little bit different about this story is that it's not quite as cut and dried as you might think it would be. And certainly it's not quite as cut and dried as the mob would make stories out to be. So there's this coffee house in Lynn, Massachusetts. It's called the White Rose Coffee House. Cato Maley is the owner. And recently on Facebook, the White Rose Coffee House declared that they would not be hosting any Coffee with a Cop community outreach events because cops, quote, uphold an unjust system and murder without consequence. Yeah. So, as Jazz Shaw writes, needless to say, that didn't go over well at all, as you might imagine. The howling mob says, no, you don't want to host these cops. You call cops murderers. Guess what? We're not going to shop. We're not going to get our coffee from you. We're going to urge others to boycott. This is gross. And it is. But here's the thing. As Jazz says, Cato Maley didn't post that Facebook article. Her 23-year-old daughter, who's also an employee of the shop, but an employee, not an owner of the shop, did post that on Facebook. Cato Maley said that she was appalled. She demanded the post be taken down. She also issued a heartfelt apology to the police, got rid of her daughter, no longer employed there. But it's like the phenomena where the wrong tweet gets tweeted 12,000 times and the correction gets retweeted 400 times. You know, that first post on Facebook by Cato Maley's daughter, that's the one that went viral. The horrified and apologetic response from her mom, who's the actual owner of this store, didn't really go viral. And Cato Maley, probably going to be shutting down. I think she is shutting down the White Rose Coffee House there in Lynn, Massachusetts. So we'll talk about this with Jazz Shaw coming up next hour. Robert Verbruggen with National Review on reducing gun violence. Suggestions, he says, they do not involve gun control. In other words, suggestions that, you know, might actually work. Plus, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joining us in Hour 3. Laura Carno with Coloradans for Civil Liberties also coming up in Hour 3. You know, I mentioned the Virginia election race, and we've got New Jersey this year. But those are the only two states that have off-year elections. Next year is going to be very, very busy. And in Colorado, you are already seeing candidates sort of jockeying for position. Governor John Hickenlooper, I believe, is term limited out. And I think there are like 9 declared candidates already in Colorado. The Journal Advocate newspaper with a story over the weekend, Colorado's controversial 2013 gun laws could loom large over the crowded 2018 governor's race. They say that the quote-unquote universal background check law that was put in place in 2013, the ban on magazines over 15 rounds, are expected to be issues in the governor's race. The paper says in the 4 years since the state took the twin steps of expanding background checks to private sales and limiting the size of magazines to 15 rounds, there remains a deep divide over beliefs and their effectiveness, with state statistics and one recent study suggesting the efforts have had a limited impact. Huh. So the deep divide seems to be, on the one side, the people who are looking at the data and saying, well, this really hasn't had an effect, and the people who, like David Duchovny in the X-Files, want to believe. They want to believe that it works. I mean, they took the time to pass the law. There were lawmakers who lost their jobs over these bills. Come on, what do you mean they don't work? The Journal Advocate says, who or what to blame for their efficacy is another point of contention, as are a number of other gun-related issues, from proposed bans on the bump stocks used in the Las Vegas shooting to a failed effort by Congress to outlaw dozens of quote-unquote assault weapons. Mm-hmm. Tony Fabian, president of the Colorado State Shooting Association, says, I don't want to hear about support for the Second Amendment. We want to hear specifics. And one of those specifics is, one of those specifics he says we better hear, is a repeal of the 2013 gun control laws. Shannon Watts, who moved from Indiana to Colorado, briefly thought about running for Congress for the open seat now that Jared Polis, current congressman, is running for governor. Shannon Watts says, what is important to us is that the laws that are in place are upheld. Now, again, we just saw that study by Garen Wintemute, UC Davis, anti-gun researcher. And he took a look at the background check laws, universal background check laws passed in 2013 in Washington State, in Colorado, and in Delaware. And they weren't looking to see what had happened to the crime rate. They weren't looking at, the number of gun seized. Now, they weren't looking at any of that. The only thing that they were looking at is whether or not background checks increased. They just wanted to see if this law that required a background check, not only on every sale of a firearm, but even temporary transfers of a firearm, if people were actually going through the background checks. And what they found in Washington State and in Colorado was that, no, there did not seem to be any appreciable increase in the number of background checks. Maryland, they said, yeah, there was one. And they said that, we need better enforcement in Washington and Colorado. Couldn't really point to what that better enforcement looked like in Delaware, but apparently they have it. Can't show you how, but they apparently have it because the numbers went up, so they must have better enforcement. It was a distinctly unscientific suggestion for a scientist to make. Well, we just need better enforcement. What would that look like? Again, you've got law enforcement officers saying, hey, they really can't enforce this law. The only way that we could possibly enforce this law would be after the fact. So what do you mean you want us to better enforce this law? We told you from the get-go this law really wasn't going to be enforceable, but you insisted that we have this law, even though we, county sheriffs across the state of Colorado, prosecutors across the state of Colorado, said, you know, there are other things that we could do, more effective things that we could do, that don't involve gun control. But the anti-gun politicians, things that, you know, frankly, we'll be talking about with Robert Verbruggen coming up next hour, but the anti-gun politicians in Colorado really wanted their gun control laws. And now they really want to keep them, even though they still can't point to how they're making a difference. We'll talk again about it with Laura Carno from Coloradans for Civil Liberties coming up in hour three. We also have our hero of the day brought to you by AdCorp Defense. We have our deal of the day today. I think we actually have two heroes today. I think we're going to give you, I know it's Monday, but we'll start off the week with two heroes of the day. Deal of the day, good guy as well. That again coming up at the top of hour three. More of the day's top Second Amendment news and information throughout the program, so stick around. When we come back, Selena Zito with SiriusXM POTUS 124 is going to join us, talking about the state of the race in Virginia's elections. So stick around. Just getting started here on this edition of Cam and Company.
Here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for the NRA Carry Guard Expo, here's Cody St. John, who is with Diamondback Firearms. Talk about your firearm.
Yes, sir. Well, we first came out with a 380. You know, the 380 became popular, so we you know, we kind of wanted to give what the people wanted. Mm-hmm. So we came out with a 380, the Diamondback 380, a striker fire, no safety, you know, single stack. It has a nice safety feature, striker fire. The firing pin's not in the lock position. You have to worry about slipping off or anything like that. Firing pin block. So that became popular, and then we wanted to take on this feat of coming out with a 9. Okay. So now we have the smallest, lightest 9mm single stack striker fire. It's right here. And this became very popular. This is the smallest and lightest 9 that you can find. Okay. So if you want to make sure that you leave the house with a firearm, that's the gun. So whether you're wearing jeans, shorts, it's going to be perfect for you. You know what I mean? Now, this right here, we're just about to release this. This is just a basically almost in the works. It's a prototype grip here, but we're coming out with the AM2. It's a subcompact. Everybody's been asking for it, and it's going to be a little modular. You're going to be able to change out grips in the future, stuff like that. It's going to have the option for night sights, and it'll come with a 10-round. And it'll also come right with the 15. And there you, so you're gonna, Diamondback is gonna have everything covered from 380, full size, smallest and lightest nines, and we even deal with ARs.
Oh wow. Sure.
So we're releasing the 6.5 Creedmoor to like right now, and we have a 308 pistol as well, 13.5-inch barrel, and it's very excited about that.
It's awesome. Well, in addition to your great firearms, I got to say you have a great shirt. We make S-word that goes bang. We can't say the S-word, but that's a great shirt.
And, we actually sold out of it. And
I bet you did.
I mean, you can find them on our website still, and it's a very popular shirt. Nine Line was nice enough to make that shirt for us, so I give them credit for that.
Cool. What's the website?
DiamondbackFirearms.com. I'm very excited about this show. It's nice seeing the people, talking to them, and seeing the families that come up here. The families is where it's at, and letting them, you know, come over here with their kids and teaching them, hey, don't touch this, don't do that. And then even people coming up saying the gun's too small. But then talking to them, it's like, well, if it's too small, you know, you're not going to be able to fit in your pocket, right? Now we're getting the guns in their pocket because now they're going to have a gun with them at all times. They can protect themselves and their family.
We are witnesses to the most ruthless attack on a president and the people who voted for him and the free system that allowed it to happen in American history. From the highest levels of government to their media, universities, and billionaires, their hateful defiance of his legitimacy is an insult to each of us. But the ultimate insult is that they think we're so stupid that we'll let them get away with it. These saboteurs slashing away with their leaks and smears, their phony accusations and gagging sanctimony, drive their daggers through the heart of our future, poisoning our belief that honest custody of our institutions will ever again be possible, so they can then build their utopia from the ashes of what they burned down. No, their fate will be failure, and they will perish in the political flames of their own fires. We are the National Rifle Association of America, and we are freedom's safest place.
My mission in life is to set a new standard by educating, training, and equipping my fellow warriors and citizens to become assets to themselves, their families, and this country. This mindset has led me on a path to become a self-protection expert, and I'm excited to share some of my knowledge with you guys. On this season of Noir, I'll be showcasing some of the best in self-defense, and I'll be showing my techniques in super slow motion. Over the next few months, NRA TV will be releasing a constant stream of interviews, scenarios, and techniques in slow motion. Get ready, guys, because this is going to be a whole new way for you to engage and become an asset.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Glad that you are with us here on a Monday. Beautiful. Well, actually, around that, it's kind of gotten cloudy. It was beautiful this morning. Now it's kind of crummy looking. But a absolutely gorgeous fall weekend. I took a road trip. We've got friends here from Arizona, and they don't have trees or green things throughout much of Arizona. So we went for a drive. We went up to Montpelier, James Madison's house. I'd never been there before. And I thought about our next guest. Anytime I go anywhere historical, I always think, I wonder if Selena's been here. So Selena Zito from SiriusXM POTUS 124, how are you?
I'm swell. How are you?
I am good. Have you ever been to Montpelier?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you beat me to it then. That was my first time.
What did you think?
I liked it. I actually, like, if I were living back then, I would have preferred to live there over Monticello.
I agree with you.
It just seemed a little bit more down to earth. You know, Thomas Jefferson had kind of some flaky ideas for architecture. It was very, Thomas Jefferson's house is very much Thomas Jefferson's house. This is a house, James Madison's place, anybody could live there.
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson's house is like being inside his brain, right? It's sort of like all over the place, and, you know, people forget he was pretty much an elitist, even though he tried to come across as sort of rumpled and the man of the people, and, yeah, it reflects him.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. So it's about an hour and a half drive from Farmville. We drove up yesterday. We stopped off. If you're ever in Gordonsville, Virginia, eat at the Barbecue Exchange, Selena. You will not regret it. It's amazing. And as we're driving home, I remarked, I said, you know, have you noticed we haven't seen one Ralph Northam sign this entire drive? Lots of, not just the little tiny yard signs, lots of big yard signs, because this is a rural area, so you got lots of space for the red, yeah. Ed Gillespie, Jill Vogel, John Adams signs. Not one sign that I saw yesterday for Ralph Northam. Now, listen, I'm not saying that yard signs are a perfect predictor of Virginia politics, but, you know, you write, Selena, that Democrats should be terrified of this governor's race.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting in that, in my travels through Virginia last week, unfortunately, I didn't get to spend as much time as I wanted, but the thing that struck me the most was the lack of enthusiasm by regular Republican voters who were very invested in last year's election, were very invested in Obama in 2008 and in 2012. But there were even two that I found that didn't even know who was running. And these are people that were, you know, activists for Hillary Clinton. They're very disappointed, not only in the Democratic Party. And it doesn't mean they're not progressive. It doesn't mean that they're not liberal. But they are very disappointed in the lack of message and focus. They believe that it shouldn't be about being against Trump, but offering, as I have said on this show many a times, offering something tangible in exchange for that support for a Republican.
Absolutely. And, you know, I thought it was interesting. You talked with Stephanie Vaughn, the Democratic County Chairperson in Winchester, and she said that they're trying to win by appealing to a wider crowd. Quote, "We very much try to have a big tent approach here. We welcome moderate, progressive, and conservative Democrats into our party, and we encourage everyone to listen to our message. Here," she says, "our issues are pretty straightforward: transportation, education, and health care." Note, by the way, I mean, like, maybe the most divisive issue of those three would be health care, right? And yet, you know, it's interesting because I think more broadly, I think that strategy is fine. I think the problem for Stephanie Vaughn is that I think there are a lot of Democrats who don't want to appeal to a wider crowd, who don't want
that big tent. That's exactly right. So Stephanie is the county chairwoman in Frederick County, Virginia, which is a big red blob. You know, I mean, it went 60% for Trump in 2016. So for them to rebuild that county back up for, you know, down ballot Democratic seats, you know, she understands that you have to welcome all Democrats in. And she admitted to me that they needed to do better messaging. But that doesn't mean better messaging happened.
No.
One of the biggest complaints I've heard about regarding Northam is not that he's not a nice man, not that he's not qualified, but that he is uninspiring and that he is sort of catering to the left as opposed to being more pragmatic.
Isn't that interesting? Because, I, you know, and the reason I say that really interesting is because we had a a primary this year, Celine, as you well know, Ralph Northam and Tom Perriello. Tom Perriello was a former Blue Dog Democrat, a very conservative Democrat, was once endorsed by the NRA, who reinvented himself as this Bernie Sanders lover. Ralph Northam voted for George W. Bush in 2004, and he sort of reinvented himself as, you know, a proud progressive. And they both tried to, like, out-leftify one another in the primary. But since then, you know, the campaign ads that I've seen for Ralph Northam are, you know, they're very generic. They are not, I'm a proud progressive, for the most part. So it's interesting that that voters are still picking up on that, you know, just a sort of, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's that inauthenticity that hurts Clinton and helped Trump in the general election and hurts Clinton again and helps Sanders in the primary contest. People want authenticity. They want to feel that you're being as honest as possible and offering your true self, as opposed to a statement or a tweet or a speech or a sign or a proclamation that hasn't been over-massaged, over-focus grouped, and someone didn't stick their finger out to see which way the wind was blowing before you release it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, and there's one other thing, too, I think, particularly when we're talking about that part of Virginia that you were in, the Winchester area, you know, they want to be left alone, Selena. They, you know, generally speaking, they don't want to have the heavy hand of government. And, you know, even when you talked with the chairperson for the county Democrats, I mean, she said that the three issues are issues are pretty straightforward: transportation, education, health care. Nothing there about gun control. Right.
Nope.
Nothing in there about the flag and whether you kneel or you flip it off these days. Nothing there about statues, which is a big
nothing
issue.
And yeah, I mean, Winchester was a very sort of tactically important town during the Civil War. It changed hands over 72 times during the Civil War, 13 times in one day. They have a respect, whether you're Republican or Democrat, for understanding and paying attention to and putting history in its right place. There is a statue there of a Confederate soldier. It's not anyone in particular. It's not a general, but it honors the Confederate soldier. Nobody in that town, Democrat or Republican, talked about tearing it down. In fact, they just voted for their first African-American Democrat mayor in the city of Winchester, and never been brought up. So, you know, there is Virginia is a really interesting place and sees its honoring of their past in a much different way than the national conversation at 30,000 feet.
I would agree with that. So do you think Virginia is an outlier, or is Virginia a bellwether for next year in the midterm elections?
I actually think it's neither.
Okay.
I think it's very specific to Virginia. It's very specific to the messaging that both candidates are delivering. And I'm always really, really cautious about labeling a special election or a statewide off-year election as being, hey, look at this. This is what's going to happen. Because, you know, things can shift. Things can change. I can remember in 2010, Republicans have lost every single special election, and there were six or seven of them leading up to the midterms, and nobody thought they were going to win the majority in the House, and then they ended up having an historic flip of the majority in that November.
Yep, and that's why, you know, you don't take anything for granted. It's certainly not in a election like this where turnout is going to be so key. And you know, so I guess, Selena, given the amount of apathy that you heard from people when you were there in the Winchester area, who should be more concerned about that voter apathy? Should it be Democrats or Republicans, you think?
I think it's Democrats. You know, when you buy a house, it's always about location, location, location. when you vote and when you are running for office, it's always about message, message, message. And that, and I found through my interviews with Democrats that there wasn't a message, a concise message that was appealing to them, that that inspired them to go out and vote. Now, that doesn't, I mean, it still doesn't mean that that population doesn't and demographics don't play into Northam's hands and he eventually wins. But I think that this is going to be a close election. You know, if Gillespie wins, he certainly wins on being a, he is a tireless retail candidate. He is nothing like Donald Trump. He is very much an establishment candidate, but it's hard to find anybody that doesn't sort of like him, even if they don't like his politics. And so I think if he wins, he wins on the back of sheer willpower and a good message on jobs and taxes.
Selena Zito with SiriusXM POTUS 124. Listen, thank you so much for coming on the program. It is always good talking with you, and look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Make sure you're following Selena on Twitter as well, at Selena Zito. We've got Steve Holbrook joining us here in just a couple of minutes, talking about the attorneys general, all Democrats, who are uniting against national right to carry reciprocity, including some state attorneys general in states where we have shall issue concealed carry laws. But we'll talk with Steve Holbrook about that coming up here in just a few minutes. Meanwhile, I saw this at NRA ILA over the weekend, the marketing tricks in gun control. Well worth your read if you've got a few minutes. Advertising professionals, they write, know that switching to a fresh new moniker and a more contemporary or dynamic logo can revitalize a tired or humdrum brand. Indeed. Starting over under a different label offers the prospect of jettisoning a less than impressive track record. And as NRA ILA points out, the gun control churn bolsters the superficial impression of a growing proliferation of anti-gun groups when, in fact, it's the same old message in a new bottle. Brady campaign started out in 1974 as the National Council to Control Handguns. Did you know that? By 1980, the National Council to Control Handguns had changed its name to Handgun Control Incorporated. Shorter, simpler. Then they changed again in 2001, becoming the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. By then, control, even back then, even by 2001, control and gun control specifically was not really a winning message. The National Council to Ban Handguns, NRA ILA pointed out, also established in 1974, changed its name in 1989 as the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Again, gun violence as opposed to banning handguns, gun control. The New Right Watch, I actually did not know this until I read this over the weekend. The New Right Watch, founded in 1988, subsequently rebranded itself as the Violence Policy Center. Did you know that, Cameron? The Violence Policy Center was once called the New Right Watch?
No, not at all. Never
I didn't either. I know. That sounds like it got a whole new mission, too.
Right.
Like, you know, just
it'd start over.
Yeah. Ceasefire Incorporated, the 1995 group started by Courtney Love with the goal of reshaping the, quote, gun violence debate in America, has since morphed into Cure Violence, a group focusing on street violence using an infectious disease control model. Huh. And Americans for Gun Safety, which was a group founded and funded by John Rosenthal, a billionaire board member of what was then Handgun Control Incorporated, folded into a new entity, folded into, origamied itself into a whole new thing called the Third Way, which, as NRA ILA points out, continues to promote the old way gun control agenda, just under a brand new moniker. Michael Bloomberg himself, Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which then sort of turned into Every Town for Gun Safety in America. Mayors for Legal Guns was still around, but it was part of that Every Town umbrella. Then you had Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, became a part of Every Town for Gun Safety. Now you've got the Every Town Creative Council, Julianne Moore, talking about, well, you know, my perfect world would just limit the number of guns that people could own. All of these rebranding efforts The latest Americans for Responsible Solutions changing its name to Giffords. And the legal community against violence is now going to be the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. All of these name changes, as NRA's Institute for Legislative Action points out, the National Rifle Association, which was founded in 1871, is still the National Rifle Association. It hasn't had to rebrand, hasn't had to all of a sudden change its name to the American Association of Rifle Owners or something like that. Mm-mm. Still the National Rifle Association, still supporting the Second Amendment, as it's done since 1871. Hasn't had to come up with new euphemisms either for support for the right to bear arms. Unlike the gun control advocates who don't want to call it gun control, right? Now you have gun safety advocates who believe that the best way to be safe with a firearm is not to own one. All right, when we return here on this edition of Cam and Company, Steve Holbrook, Second Amendment attorney and scholar, is going to join us talking about some of the anti-gun attorneys general around the country. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company right after this.
Speaking with Dave Roden with Vertex. Tell us, what is Vertex?
Yeah, Vertex is a brand that really focuses on the low-profile customer. So whether it's a federal customer or the civilian who's concealed carrying, we're trying to give them a low-vis alternative that doesn't scream tactical necessarily, that they can be the gray man in the crowd.
So you're trying to outfit people properly, but without having a screaming sign saying, I'm outfitted properly.
Exactly. Like, look at me, you know, or look at my Molly, look at my Velcro. Yes, sir. So, yeah, we're trying to give them options.
So how did this all come about?
So Vertex started in 2009 as a project to create a low-vis alternative pant and for a three-letter agency. And that took off and did really well. They did that in conjunction with Arc'teryx on the first design of the pant. And then they continued to roll out additional products and apparel. And then a few years ago, they got into bags. And that's really kind of catapulted the awareness of the brand.
So tell us about the bag you have there.
Yes, sir. This is the EDC Commuter Sling. It's probably the most popular bag that they make. It's a sling-style bag designed to be worn over the shoulder. A couple of great features about this. First, there's an oversized luggage tag-type handle. So in the dark, I can reach around behind myself, grab that bag, find that handle, pull it around in front of me, and then quickly pull this open and come out with whatever I need to have on the inside. A couple of nice things about this bag is that, you know, one, I can either integrate this with an existing Kydex holster, my favorite, you know, one of choice.
Yes.
Or we also make some what we call tactigami pouches, which allows them to Velcro in the holster. And it's great. It works with left-handed or right-handed, depending on how you fold it up. We have additional pouches for mags, for medic, AR, pretty much anything you would need to put into a bag. The other nice thing is we can put in ballistic panels into this bag as well.
Really?
So not only is it a concealed carry bag, but I can, you know, when I spin it around in front of me, it's in front of my A-zones, give me some core protection, or I could actually run my hand through this, what we call the Captain America feature.
Wow.
You know, overseas, there's a lot of knife attacks that are going on, and they're teaching parry techniques with your bag. So now I've got something I can actually put in my hand to defend myself and provide some ballistic protection at the same time.
Wow, that is pretty well thought out, pretty cool. And I know a couple people I know very well are going to probably want one of those. So we'll have to talk when we get off the air.
Outstanding.
Dave Roden with Vertex. You talked about the pants.
Yes, sir.
So let's talk about the pants. That's where it all started, right?
Absolutely.
For this certain three-letter agency.
So the last year we spent doing some product development meetings across the country, meeting with guys in the field and asking them what they wanted. And in short, the consistent feedback was, give me a pant that basically could be sold or would fit in at an REI, you know, an outdoor recreational store with some tactical features. So we've come out with a couple of different styles of pants, but this is the hide pant. The hide we're doing in two weights. We're doing a 7-ounce and a 5-ounce. Both of the pants have several different features that kind of help the end user. One is a pocket on the side here. When I open this up, not only do I have storage, but it's all mesh airflow on the inside. So I'm at the range on a hot day, allows airflow to get in there and cool it off. Both pants are also treated with our 375 technology, which is a climate management technology. It works with the IR of the body. In 1 yard of fabric, I have the same surface area as a football field, which helps pull heat and moisture away from me. We also have some pockets on the sides for mags. We have a wallet trap inside of here in the back pocket, so that way it doesn't prevent your wallet from getting pickpocketed. And then we, along the yoke, we also do an AR mag pouch as well on the left and the right side. And it's canted, so that way as I come down, I can get a positive purchase with my thumb, get that mag out of there. And then one last little feature, you know, obviously we have two-way stretch and, you know, 180 gusset for range of motion. But we do a little hidden pocket inside the cuff here. Cool. So for law enforcement, if they need a cuff key or, you know, some Kevlar thread or something like that for an E&E situation, it gives guys some other options. And, again, with the contrast stitch, it looks sharp, it's lightweight, it's breathable, and I think it's going to do well for them.
Wow, that is pretty cool. So I'm seeing a lot of thought going into this stuff. So, by the way, I'm speaking with Dave Roden of Vertex. Just quickly take us through the process when you guys sit down to develop this. You really are thinking this stuff out well.
We try to do a few different techniques. Obviously, meeting with the right people out in the field is the first step. And then we really try to tell them, you know, a couple of things. Bring in the right products that you guys like out in the field. And what we do is we can Frankenstein these things together. For example, if you like the waistband off of this pant, you like the fabric here, you like the pocket placement from this one, dude, we can do anything you want. So just tell us what you need and we'll make it. So that way it achieves your goals out in the field.
How do we get more information about Vertex?
Simple. Just hit the website at vertex.com, V-E-R-T-X.com, and they can find the product and the gear there.
So it's Vertex, V-E-R-T-X.
Yes, sir.
.com. Dave Roden with vertex.com. Great stuff. Keep on doing what you're doing, and keep us up to speed when you have new products. We love talking to you, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Glad you've joined us today. Jazz Shav, Hot Air next hour. Robert Verbruggen with National Review as well. And right now, I want to welcome to the program Steve Hallberg, Second Amendment attorney and scholar. Steve, good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here as usual.
Well, I'm glad to have you with us. You know, normally when we ask you to come on and talk about what state attorneys generals are doing, it's an amicus brief, but that's not the case here. This isn't a court case. This is a letter signed by Democratic attorneys general from 17 states, urging Congress to vote down national right to carry reciprocity. New York, which is a may-issue state, California, a may-issue state, also Pennsylvania, a shall-issue state, Iowa as well, sent in a letter saying that the federal reciprocity proposals being debated on Capitol Hill, quote, will lead to the death of police officers and civilians, the proliferation of gun traffickers and acts of terrorism and other mass violence, Steve.
What a laugh. I mean, this is the same stuff that we keep seeing. This letter was organized, and the chief author is Eric Schneiderman, Attorney General of New York. Just look at New York as an example. They only issue permits to people in state. There's been litigation. The courts there say they don't have to issue them to anyone from another state. And that means you go through that state, you get arrested. Well, we've got the federal interstate transport provision. They arrest them anyway. They say federal law doesn't apply here. This is New York. I mean, most of the states now are shall issue. Most of them recognize permits from other states. And this is the point when we really need national reciprocity. There's a bill in the House, a bill in the Senate. They both have widespread support. And here you have 17 state attorney generals who are opposed. Now, it's not like there's 17 states that are against concealed carry or even shall issue concealed carry like Virginia's listed. We have an attorney general who's anti the laws of Virginia. That doesn't reflect Virginia, and it's the same in Pennsylvania, other states like that that have very good laws on carry. So this is really just a political antic. It's a letter addressed to Congress. Instead of coming from constituents, it's coming from attorneys general. And they're saying don't adopt this, but we have every policy reason in the world to. It's not going to do anything about enhancing drug traffickers and criminals. It's going to make citizens safer from criminals and drug traffickers. So it's something that the time has come. We've got so many other areas where Congress has legislated under the Interstate Commerce Clause. They should pass this legislation, which is justified not only as a regulation of interstate commerce, but as an enhancement and protection of Second Amendment guarantees.
Talking again with Steve Hallberg, Second Amendment attorney and scholar. And you know, Steve, You chuckled when I read that quote from the letter talking about, you know, the a parade of horribles that will ensue if we have a national right to care reciprocity. And you know, you've been around this debate long enough to know that these arguments don't really change whether it is, you know, we're talking about a shall issue right to carry in Florida in 1987, or campus carry in the state of Texas in 2014, or national right to care reciprocity in 2017. You know, for 30 years, these gun control advocates have been claiming that when you allow Americans to exercise their Second Amendment rights to bear arms, that you're going to have, you know, shootouts and blockbuster parking lots. I remember that one in Ohio. We don't even have blockbusters anymore, Steve, but we still have shall issue right to carry in the state of Ohio.
Well, also, even if you look at the may issue states like New York or Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
there are some jurisdictions that simply don't issue them. There's others that issue them on a wide basis. Upstate New York and parts of Massachusetts, no problem getting your permit. They don't have any more of a crime problem than the ones that where they deny them. In fact, many jurisdictions nationwide, you have a lot higher crime rate in places where they don't issue. But the point is that you go through all this process. I mean, tell me this. Are drug traffickers going to get concealed weapon permits and then they're going to rely on that for reciprocity? No, they're violators of the law. They can't get the permits in the first place. Most of them are convicted felons. And why would they want to bring their identity attention to law enforcement anyway? So you've got a lot lower crime rate by persons who have these permits. It's so small, it's hardly worth a percentage. And they're one of the most law-abiding groups of people nationwide, probably right up there with Sunday school teachers. So the whole charade is like, it's just like when they denounced the SHARE Act in hearings last month. So you have a right to travel, and if you're a law-abiding citizen, then that's, once again, it's about violent crime and drug traffickers and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we're talking about is making America safer, not more dangerous.
Absolutely. Steve, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is good talking with you, and I hope we get a chance to do this again very soon.
My pleasure, Cam, as always.
Steve Hallbrook, Second Amendment attorney and scholar with us here on Cam and Company. Now, as I mentioned, you know, the last time that we were talking about a group of state attorneys general, it was a group of 12 who were filing a friend of the court brief in California, hoping that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals would reject an injunction granted by a federal judge and allow California's ban on magazines over 10 rounds to proceed. Because right now in California, that law is on hold. The federal judge has said, listen, there are millions potentially of people who legally possess these magazines right now. And as soon as this law goes into effect, they're all criminals. Every one of them. As long as they're possessing that that property of theirs that you've now told them they can no longer possess. So I've heard the argument so far. Don't think the state is likely to prevail on the arguments that it's presented. We'll go to trial. But, you know, I'm not going to let this law go into effect if I am not confident that the law is going to be upheld. And if there is damage that can be done to these individuals who are legal owners of these magazines in California. Now you've got these attorneys general saying, no. Turn them into criminals right now. Turn them into criminals. And you know what? We want, this is sort of implied from some of these attorneys general, but they want to turn gun owners in their states into criminals too. I mean, if you're out there supporting California's law, which tells the people who have possessed these magazines since at least 1998, you can't have them anymore, and you can't sell them because you can't legally sell them in California. So you've got to get rid of them somehow. You can turn them in to the local police, or you can you could maybe move them out of state. No way of us knowing, since you haven't registered your magazine. I guess you could do that, but you can't keep them. That's the key.
you can't keep this property that you legally own because we're saying you can't legally own it. It's disheartening to see that there are a dozen attorneys general around the country who, again, see this as a good thing. I even saw, I think it was over the weekend, I can't remember who it was, but somebody had tweeted out that, well, you know, it's more of a symbolic ban. A symbolic ban. And this was a supporter of the law, by the way. Said it was a symbolic ban similar to laws that would allow people to carry during a state of emergency. You know, it doesn't really have any real impact. It's just symbolic. Well, first of all, if you are under a state of emergency and you now can legally carry, it's not really symbolic. Conversely, in California, if you possess this magazine, if the law were to go into effect and you were to possess this magazine and you were somehow to be found with this magazine, you could be facing a year in jail. That's not symbolic. That's a real cost to you. Actually, the financial cost to you, I think, is $1,000 fine. Or up to a year and or up to a year in jail. So it doesn't really seem like symbolism. To me, if this were a symbolic law, the punishment would be like, you've got to write lines. You got to go pick up litter. Jail time, nah, that's a real crime. They want to turn the possession of something that you legally have owned for nearly 20 years into a crime. And there are a dozen attorneys general around the country who say, yeah, that looks good. Let's try to do that. It is, again, just kind of mind-boggling to me. But so far, Ninth Circuit has not overturned that decision. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, as the Democrats look forward, they think, to winning the governorship and undoing much of what has been done under Governor Chris Christie. No more pardons for anybody who makes a mistake and brings their legally owned firearm into the state of New Jersey. No, you'll be looking at years behind bars. Unfortunately for these anti-gun activists and these anti-gun lawmakers, they can't do anything about a court decision on stun guns. And so New Jersey's ban on stun guns is going away. Public comment period for the end of the ban on stun guns ended over the weekend. And soon, NorthJersey.com says, residents will be free to buy the devices for the first time since 1985. That is amazing. NorthJersey.com says the dismantling of New Jersey's stun gun ban comes 6 months after the Attorney General's office signed a consent order acknowledging that the law violated the Second Amendment. But while gun groups cheer, NorthJersey.com says New Jersey's law enforcement community is ambivalent about the dismantling of the state's 32-year law. They don't actually quote anybody. They just say they're ambivalent. What does that mean? It means they don't really care. Right? So while gun groups cheer, New Jersey's law enforcement community says, meh, we don't really see it as an issue. Okay. Maybe that's just an attempt by NorthJersey.com to try to gin up some controversy where none exists. The paper does say that the Attorney General dropped his defense of the ban after a 2016 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court declaring similar restrictions in Massachusetts to be unconstitutional. Following the consent order, a federal judge gave the state 180 days to create new regulations. And so the public comment period has ended. Can't be a minor. Other than that, there are a few other restrictions, but other than that, yes, you will soon be able to buy a stun gun. And again, that was based off of the Catano case. That was the last time that the Supreme Court, with the exception of dissents from justices urging the majority to take a case, the Catano case dealing with stun guns in Massachusetts, that's the last time that the court has said anything on the Second Amendment. And it was about 6 weeks after Antonin Scalia passed away, and it was a unanimous decision So all nine justices. And they said Massachusetts' ban on stun guns, on the face of it, unconstitutional. The Second Amendment protects arms that were developed after 1791, which was the argument, by the way, from the Massachusetts State Supreme Court that, well, stun gun, founding fathers could never have envisioned stun guns. Therefore, clearly, they don't fall under the Second Amendment. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's absurd. Clearly, they do. And so anti-gun activists, anti-stun gun activists, disappointed by that ruling. But soon, a little bit of your right of self-defense will return there in the Garden State of New Jersey. All right, stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company. It's coming up right after this.
Talking with Chad Ito, some Kel-Tec. Chad, great talking to you. Thanks.
Nice to have you here. It's our pleasure to have you in the booth.
Well, and there's a lot of stuff to talk about, including this bad boy, which is now shipping, I understand, right?
It is, yep. Started shipping the KSG 25. It's if you're familiar with the standard KSG, it holds 7 and 7+1 with 2 3/4 shells. This particular gun here, we actually designed it for our German friends because they have overall length requirements over there, and they love the KSG. So we thought, well, let's do something for them. So we extended the tubes and the barrel. So you got a 30.5-inch barrel, and it actually holds 12 and 12 in each tube in one of the chambers. So a box of shells you fit in this bad boy here. So it adds about 2 3/4 pounds of lead.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so lots of firepower.
Right. That's like that that really, really old motto for Henry rifles back in the 19th century, right, where you load on Sunday, shoot all week.
That's right.
Same thing with this.
That's right, yeah. And we took it to SHOT Show just this past year, and it, you know, we thought, well, let's just show it at the show. You know, it's an international show. Lots of people come. A lot of Europeans come, and this is something for them. But our American audience just freaked out. I mean, this is the only gun they picked up in the booth. So it was kind of like, it reminded me of when we first released the original KSG. Like, it was the rock star of the show. Well, we did it again with this thing here. And it shocked me, because when I first saw it, I was like, why? Like, what is this for? And then they explained to me it's for our German friends, and everybody fell in love with it, and now I'm on board. Like, I love this thing. It's super cool, because it's just one of those because-you-can kind of guns, you know?
Right, absolutely. So. I mean, listen, if you want to just go out, and I imagine this would be a very impressive self-defense firearm. If I'm breaking into somebody's house at 2 o'clock in the morning, they're pointing that at me, I've got somewhere else I need to be.
If you need more shells than this, you're in big trouble.
Right?
Yeah.
But if you just want to go out, I mean, like, I'd love to take that out to a sporting clays course, honestly.
Right, and we actually have we make a choke adapter for it, so you can stick wind chokes in there, too. Take it out and have some fun with it.
That is awesome.
Turn some heads.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's what it's about, right?
Sure.
It's just about turning those heads. Frankly, I imagine there are a lot of gun owners who are shocked that this would be legal in Germany. You're right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know all the laws over there in Europe, but each country is different, you know, and it just so happens that Germany needed a gun this long, so we did it for them.
Well, yeah. I think it's really, really impressive. It is shipping now. As a matter of fact, it's also the cover model on the NRA store tactical catalog right now.
Yeah, we're proud of that. Yeah, I mean, it's just, again, like when the first KSG came out, we were kind of like, who's going to like this thing, you know? Is this a practical firearm, you know? And of course, now the KSG is like a household name, you know? In fact, there's a lot of people that don't understand who makes the gun. You know, they just call it either the Kel-Tec or the KSG. They don't really put the two together until they come to our booth. So the gun they speak for themselves. We have a lot of product recognition, you know, and that gun kind of really launched all that for us.
Absolutely. So where do you go from here, I guess, is the next question, Chad.
Smaller? Let's make a super small one now, you know, something for the truck maybe, you know, so something maybe holds 7 or 8 shells, you know, that's really compact.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we'll think about doing something like that. You know,
I look forward to seeing what the research and development comes up with at Kel-Tec. It must be like Wonka land there, you know, where if you can dream it, you can do it.
That's right. And that's the beauty of Kel-Tec is, you know, we're not run by a board of directors or anything like that. We're a privately owned company, so we can kind of really just do whatever we want. And it's been awesome. It's been a great experience being there. I pinch myself sometimes when George, the owner, comes by and he's got a gun in a case. You know, I'm like, uh-oh, what's he up to now? So I follow him into the range to see what's going on, you know. And occasionally he'll show me what he's working on, you know, when it's getting close to going to production so I can tell people about it. But it's really neat to watch a firearm go literally from, AutoCAD and the computer to the range, and George is in there test firing it. It's pretty neat. So
that is really neat. Chad Enos with Kel-Tec. Thanks for joining us on Cam & Company.
watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company. Fueled by Hornady starts right this second. On the program this hour, we've got Jazz Shaw of Hot Air talking about the mob in Massachusetts shutting down a coffee shop over anti-police sentiments. Quickly apologized for the individual making those statements, no longer employed by her mom. But doesn't matter. Coffee shop looks like it's still going to be closed. Also, Robert Verbruggen of National Review, reducing gun violence, suggestions that do not involve gun control. Things that actually work, as opposed to things like a quote-unquote universal background check law that doesn't lead to increased background checks, certainly not by violent criminals. Meanwhile, you know, we were talking with Selena Zito last hour about the Virginia governor's race. Washington Examiner's Philip Wegman says Michael Bloomberg just made Virginia's governor's race a referendum on gun control, hoping to ride to the rescue of Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam 2 weeks ahead of the Virginia governor's race. Every town for gun safety, according to the Washington Post, will drop another $400,000 in the state of Virginia after an earlier $1 million commitment. I'd actually heard that that was going to be even more than $700,000, according to the Washington Post. $400,000 to Ralph Northam, $300,000 to Democratic Attorney General Mark Herring in the final 2 weeks before Election Day. Philip Wegman at the Washington Examiner says, while the Bloomberg cash could rile up the Democratic base and bring Northam victory, it could just as easily backfire and deliver a win to Republican Ed Gillespie. Without new voters to win over, the race is about getting reliable voters to the polls. You know, so 2 years ago, Michael Bloomberg decided that he was going to invest in the Virginia election races. Now, we didn't have a governor's race, so this was the state Senate. And Michael Bloomberg thought, you know what? State Senate's pretty close. We can flip a couple of seats, just a couple. Then we can turn the Senate from a pro-gun legislative body to an anti-gun legislative body. And so he targeted two state Senate districts in the state of Virginia, just two. And man, he flooded the districts with cash. Millions of dollars spent on these two state Senate races. Nobody had really ever seen anything like the amount of spending on a state Senate race, what they saw from Michael Bloomberg. And it didn't work. It didn't work. In Northern Virginia, a Democratic seat stayed Democratic. Anti-gun seat stayed anti-gun. And in the suburbs of Richmond, an anti-gun candidate went down to defeat. Michael Bloomberg did get the voter turnout in Richmond, Virginia. But gun owners and Second Amendment supporters turned out in the Richmond suburbs and exurbs and delivered Michael Bloomberg's candidate an election night loss. So now you've got these statewide races. But again, and just as we talked about with Selena, it is about the turnout. And there is a I think a great deal of apathy. Now, I'm curious, Cameron, I talked about, and I know that it's, I know you can't predict based on yard signs, but I really was struck by the lack of a single Ralph Northam sign in like a 120-mile round trip yesterday. So what is the Ralph Northam signage situation in Northern Virginia, which I would expect would be Ralph Northam's stronghold?
Last time we talked about this a few weeks ago, there was that Gillespie sign here in Old Town Alexandria, which still shocks me that it's standing there. And I don't know what it is. And we have here in Alexandria, in the neighborhood I live in Delray, they have the there was a recent fall festival, art festival, and there was a Democrat booth and a Republican booth. And I barely even saw, you know, when you go to these things, you usually see people walking around because they hand out the stickers. You know, people don't want to carry,
right.
They give out the yard signs if you want, but no one wants to carry on a yard sign at a festival. But I was struck because I pay attention to this stuff too, and I didn't see a lot of stickers. usually you see people, wearing their politics on their sleeve, as they say. And I've seen a lot more stickers at these events. It's a handful of them. But I think something that you and Selena discussed is there's just, a lot of people don't know who's running. And I think part of the issue is Trump takes up so much oxygen in the news cycle and the political cycle, pro or con, however you feel about it. I think people are just tired of politics. Because not only is Trump, but everything's just so political now. Your football, the NFL, the politics, and I think people are just tired of it. They're looking for any respite, and they think like a local governor's race. I mean, how many people really know their congressperson or their senator? I doubt they really care. A lot of people just don't care about their governor. Sadly, I'm certainly not a proponent of that, but I think people there's just such fatigue at this point.
I suspect that you are correct about that. Now, you would think, again, if you spend a lot of time on social media, you would think that fatigue would be counteracted by the Trump rage that has existed nonstop since election night, right, a year ago. And certainly there is an element of the electorate that is fueled by rage. And every morning they get up and, wow, I'm so angry still, right? And will they show up on election day for a race that doesn't involve Donald Trump? Some of them will, right? Some of them will if I elect Ralph Northam, it's going to be like a giant middle finger to Donald Trump. And they'll go and they'll vote. But again, how many of those people who are so loud, right, we're very aware that they exist, but when you start counting heads, how many are there versus the quiet people who you don't really notice because they're quiet? But like Selena found in Winchester, couldn't even tell you he's running for governor. Volunteered for Hillary Clinton. Again, this time last year, they were knocking on doors. And this year, I don't even know who's running. I'll probably vote. But I won't vote a straight ticket. That was the guy who didn't know who was running for governor, who volunteered for Hillary Clinton. He told Selena, I'll probably vote, don't know who for, won't vote a straight ticket. All right, if you're 2 weeks out from Election Day and I'll probably vote, are you really going to probably vote, or are you telling me that because a reporter is talking to you about politics? I don't know that that guy's going to show up on Election Day. As Phil Wegman writes at the Washington Examiner, Northam cleaning up in wealthy liberal elite Northern Virginia, but losing momentum in central and eastern Virginia. Patrick Murray, the director of the Monmouth University Polling Institute, says from Hampton Roads all the way to Chesapeake Bay should be an area where Northam does well. It's his home region. Democrats have done well there in the last couple of election cycles, but he doesn't appear to be as strong there with his base as he needs to be. Right now, according to Monmouth, that part of the state is split 48% Republican, 45% for the Democrats. Wegman says that Bloomberg could help Northam in the candidate's eastern backyard. The anti-gun mayor, though, could also just as easily shoot his guy in the foot in the central part of the state. It has happened before. Indeed, it has. I can tell you that there are an awful lot of Virginia voters, and I don't think this is specific only to Virginia, but Bloomberg has had sort of a contentious relationship with Virginia for a good long time, sending his private detectives down to the state, trying to conduct these little sting operations in the state of Virginia. That met with legislative efforts, successful efforts, to bar Bloomberg's private detectives from engaging in stunts like that in the future. That was nearly 10 years ago in the state of Virginia. So the idea nationwide, I think, that you would have out-of-state billionaires try to spend millions of dollars in states where they don't live to influence elections, that does, I think, rankle a lot of Americans. Bloomberg does it. It's not just with the Second Amendment. I mean, he spent, I think, something like $19 million on a soda tax in Berkeley. I mean, it was some ridiculous amount of money on a local soda tax. So I guess, $1.7 million on the Virginia elections, that's just a drop in the bucket for Michael Bloomberg. But it is enough to annoy and to energize and to activate a lot of Virginia voters who say, listen, this is my state, and I don't need a out-of-state billionaire coming in and trying to dictate the laws that I will live under. So we did see that 2 years ago, again, in the Richmond suburbs. A reminder, if you are a Virginia gun owner, Election Day, 2 weeks from tomorrow, and make sure that you are getting, not only that you're registered to vote, again, be that annoying guy or gal for the next couple of weeks, asking every gun owner you know, hey, are you registered to vote? You know, we got an election coming up in a couple of weeks. Are you aware of that? Do you know where your polling place is? You good to go? You can talk about the anti-gun record of Ralph Northam. You can talk about the support that he's getting from Michael Bloomberg. But let every gun owner you know understand the importance of this election. Let them understand the importance of turnout and that their vote is not going to be wasted, that their vote really does matter this year. And spread that message far and wide between now and Election Day. And again, if you're outside of the state of Virginia, oh, by the way, that goes for you in New Jersey, too, because you've got elections coming up, too, in a couple of weeks. But if you're outside of these states where we've got statewide elections, you can still help. You can still volunteer. NRAILA.org, that is the place to go. And you can be active no matter where you live. So, you know, if a billionaire from out of state is going to come in and try to change our gun laws, I guess it's cool if non-billionaires from out of state come in and try to defend our Second Amendment rights. In fact, we would greatly appreciate your support. All right. By the way, speaking of Virginia, coming up on tomorrow's Kamen Company, we're going to spend some time with Andrew Langer. I don't know what's going on in Williamsburg. A few weeks ago, you know, you had a speech by the head of the ACLU in Virginia that was interrupted by a local, the William & Mary chapter of Black Lives Matter, protesting this speech on free speech. Then last week, you actually had an improvised explosive device that detonated near the campus of William & Mary. The college police department chief, Deb Cheeseborough, sent out a campus-wide email. Said last night there was an explosive device discovered off campus in a Colonial Williamsburg parking lot at Francis and South Boundary Streets. A 30-year-old individual from, I believe, Gloucester, Virginia, has been arrested now and charged with placing that IED. But, again, what has typically been a fairly quiet college campus, College of William & Mary abuts directly Colonial Williamsburg. So this is a, you know, family-friendly, not only a college campus, but a tourist attraction. And an IED going off there in Williamsburg. So we're going to talk about what's going on there in this small Virginia town, how stuff like this might be impacting the governor's race. They do say all politics is local, but again, that's coming up on tomorrow's Cam and Company. When we return after a quick timeout, we're going to talk with our friend Jazz Shad, Hot Air, about this story over the weekend. Massachusetts Coffee Shop, their Facebook page, all of a sudden says, listen, we're not going to do the community with a cops event because cops can murder people and get away with it. As you can imagine, the response by the local community was pretty swift, and it was pretty outraged. And this story went far and wide. And the owner of this coffee company said, I am so sorry. This was my daughter posting this. This does not reflect the views and opinions of me or the business. Daughter's no longer associated with the business. Well, Mom's not going to be associated with the business, it sounds like, because it sounds like the business is closing. So we obviously live in a culture. Again, these stories happen every day. Somebody says something or a business posts something, and we vent our spleen. We let them know in no uncertain terms. We don't like what they have to say. There are consequences for what they say. But do we wait until we get the full story? And does it matter? To how many people does it matter? The facts of this, other than, the only fact that matters is that this went up on Facebook. And now this business should shut down. We'll talk about it again with Jazz Shaw from Hot Air coming up after a quick break. Stick around. We'll be right back with more Cam and Company right after this.
Speaking with Claudia Olson with NRA Youth Programs and Education and Training. Claudia, welcome to the program. We're talking about the Outstanding Achievement Youth Award presented by Brownells. Tell us, what's it all about?
Oh, it's to award youth who have participated in the shooting sports with an award. They have core requirements that they have to fulfill. They have to be at least six. They can be no older than 21. And so there are the core requirements. They have to have taken a basic firearm class. There is those who have had that prior, and their knowledge is above that. So I do accept an instructor class or a coach class, all to encourage youth to participate more, to then also play it forward. They have to participate in the marksmanship qualification program. And there's a whole list of core requirements, five in all, that they have to do. And also then they have to have at least five of the elective requirements. And there's a whole list of different NRA programs, competitions that they have to participate in to qualify.
And why is it important that NRA do this?
Well, we have to reach out to the youth and award those who are putting forth in the shooting program and giving them an award money to use it either for school to further their shooting career or if they are planning on going to a trade school. We made it an award, not a scholarship, for the purposes that the youth can decide what to spend it on.
How do we get more information about the Outstanding Achievement Youth Award?
You can visit our website and you will be able to download the form that you need to fill out and submit with your portfolio.
I'm here with Bill Bear with Bear Arms Custom Holsters. Bill, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
All right, tell me, what is Bear Arms?
Well, we're an indoor gun range. We're a training facility and we're a gun store back in Asheville, Kentucky. But we also make custom Kydex holsters where we can print any logo, any design, anything you can imagine on a custom Kydex holster. And we do that all in 2 to 3 days before it's shipped out. So that's kind of a first and only in the industry. We're really quick. We employ veterans. I'm a veteran. I served in the United States Air Force during Desert Storm. I served in the U.S. Army, and we employ all veterans. I'm also a retired police officer. I served 22 years, so I know what it is to carry. So when we design holsters, we know what we need to put into it.
Well, thank you for your service. So tell me a little bit about the range first, then we'll look at some of these holsters.
Yeah, we got a 12-lane indoor gun range in Ashland, Kentucky. We offer all sorts of training, from basic firearms training to CCDW. We also do advanced training, like for law enforcement, for military personnel, or just the civilian that would like to learn some advanced training. We actually have canine training, which is kind of unique in a gun range. So we offer all types of protection, whether it's handgun or with canines.
So show me a holster here.
Yeah. Let me grab one. These are our custom Kydex holsters. Like I said, we can print anything you want on one. If you wanted to put your kids' pictures on one, we can put one on there. Anything, you can choose from all kinds of different types of backs. It's kind of needed. We're the only one I know, I'm aware of, that can do that, and we allow you to design your own. So you can do it. It's kind of a holster that meets your personality.
Cool. How do we get more information about Bear Arms?
Go to BearArmsHolsters.com. That's BareHolsters.com.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Glad that you have joined us. Coming to you once again from Farmville, Virginia today, about 3 hours south of Washington, D.C., which is where we find Jazz Shaw of Hot Air on Twitter, at Jazz Shaw. Jazz, how are you, sir?
I've arrived in our nation's capital in one piece.
Just the the sheer ness in your voice there. Well, I, for your sake, I hope that it doesn't last that long, that you don't have to spend a lot of time there. Are you able to get over into Virginia?
It's an overnight trip. I'm going back home tomorrow night, back to the country.
So. Okay. Good for you. Stay in Virginia if you can next time.
Well, I am technically in Virginia, but I can, like, see the bridge into D.C. from here. So
so the hives are breaking out. I get it. I get it. I sometimes have the same experience whenever I go up there. There's something about that country air. All of a sudden you get allergic once you get inside the Beltway.
Yep.
Yep. Okay. Jazz is very talkative today. Let's talk about your column, Jazz, at Hot Air, how the mob shut down a Massachusetts coffee shop over anti-police sentiments. You know, this phenomena of you see something, somebody posts something, and people, you know, respond with outrage. This is nothing new. You can find these stories every day. But what I thought was so interesting about your story is the fact that, you know, there to me anyway, it seemed like there were some mitigating factors that maybe the mob should have taken into consideration here. But the mob doesn't really deal with nuance or mitigating factors, does it?
No, nuance and subtlety are not generally the forte of the mob, no matter which side the mob comes from.
Yeah.
I wasn't so – I get a lot of pushback, believe it or not, from people saying, no, it doesn't matter because the daughter was – for those of you who don't know, this was a coffee shop in Massachusetts, in Lyle, Massachusetts, or Lynn, Massachusetts, where someone had posted a Facebook notice – saying that they would not be participating in any of these what were called coffee with a cop events, where the community could get to know the local police and, you know, try to increase understanding, because police are awful and they murder without consequence and yada, yada, yada. And that got a lot of people upset. And there was an immediate move to boycott and nasty phone calls and threats. But it turns out it wasn't actually the owner. It was her daughter who did work there, who no longer works there. And the owner, the mother, immediately demanded, as soon as she found out about it, that the post be taken down and issued a heartfelt apology to the police and an invitation and all that. But it was too late. And now her business is closing down because all of her customers left. So with that as the backdrop, yeah, there were mitigating factors. People made arguments to the contrary. But I kind of think that's a symptom of the free market. People do vote with their wallets. What really got me a little more than that was the author of the column, which I don't have up in front of me, but she's a columnist for the Globe in Boston, who just kept sliding in these non sequiturs just here and there, talking about how the mob attacks, that it's usually attacking people whose opinions are too far to the left.
What?
I was like, really? Because, first of all, if your opinion is that cops are terrible and you shouldn't interact with them because they murder people, I don't know if that's just a left wing, if you can expect everybody on the left wing to agree with you. There are a lot of people on the left of good faith who don't feel that way about the police. And frankly, the rest of the mobs that I've seen, the vast majority, and I listed a few of those cases, you know, photographers and cake baker, you know, bakers and hall rental people who have a religious objection to a gay wedding if they get invited to attend one, even if it's a fictional one. And then they get closed down by these mobs. And I don't think that's really people with too far left-wing opinions.
No, you know, so it's interesting. I mean, like that is, about as predictable as the actions of the mob, by the way, of the online mob. The online mob reacts with outrage. The online pundit reacts with, falsehoods, right? And blinders, I should say, where they're only, and I would love, I wish that she would have offered any examples. Did she offer up any examples of left-leaning people who were targeted by the mob other than this coffee shop?
No, not one.
Happens all the time. I just
that's usually how
can't think
goes.
Of any. Yeah, had to cut those out.
And in my response, I actually linked to a number of examples of the opposite, which aren't hard to find.
No.
If I could have found one, I would have provided a link for her, but that was the only one I'd really heard of. And again, I don't consider that a valid left-wing position, really. That's just a nasty position.
It is. I mean, I wouldn't even it's kind of interesting that she ascribes that to the left in this country. Because as you say, I know a lot of people who would proclaim themselves to be liberals, even progressives, who don't believe that cops are murderers. But, you know, getting back to the those mitigating factors for a second, it does strike me, Jazz. I mean, I don't know how you do this. I don't know how you, because it's sort of the same phenomenon, right, where you get a tweet that's wrong and it gets 40,000 retweets and then the correction gets like 40. This to me seems like, you know, the story itself went viral, but the actions that the owner of the business took did not. And
right.
How do we fix that?
You get rid of the internet.
You get rid of the internet?
Yes, because the internet is responsible for almost everything bad in the country right now. It's ruining everything. It really is. The internet has provided all sorts of great things, but it ruins like several orders of magnitude more things than it improves. I realize that sounds depressing. We'll put both of us out of a job probably. but no, it's just I don't see how you do get rid of it, because correcting something exciting and faux rage worthy with something factual and kind of boring is no fun, and you're not going to get those 40,000 retweets of the correction. You're saying, how do we fix that? Beats me. I don't think you do, because, you know, someone famously very recently completely in at the wrong time drew up the quote about a lie makes it around the world before the truth gets its shoes on or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this really was one of those cases. And it was like, well, this is the position of this coffee shop, and they should be closed. And it was this 23-year-old kid who got in a huge fight with her mother and then quit. So, you know, the correction was important, but nobody wanted to talk about it. And I don't see that changing. I really don't.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting because you seem to think about these things, Jazz, you know, how they impact our society at large. And that's one of the things that I like about you. And you know, as I was reading your piece this weekend, I was wondering, like, where is there, you talk about the, you know, how the internet has ruined everything. I don't think it's ruined everything, and I certainly don't think you can get rid of it. But I do wonder about redemption. And do we live in a post-redemption society? Is redemption always just going to be seen as a cold and calculated move? Like Harvey Weinstein is a perfect example of this, right? So Harvey Weinstein gets caught. He gets outed. People start talking. And what does Harvey Weinstein do? Well, I'm going to go get treatment. I'm going to go get help. And then I got to find a way to deal with my anger. So I'm going to go after the NRA, right? He's already looking for redemption before he's done anything to try to even redeem himself. Now, I would say that the owner of this business actually did try to redeem the business, right? Took down the post, apologized profusely, reached out to law enforcement there in the community, and her daughter's no longer working there. But do we as a society, do we as a culture, do we care about redemption? Is that a redemption story a worthwhile story anymore, or is it simply about the tearing down?
I think there are good, in air quotes, stories of redemption when the sinner actually redeems themselves and goes out and establishes a track record of being different and making a difference. Even though I don't think it was the most effective one, I was thinking about the story of Michael Vick, who got caught with the dog fighting thing, and he just lost a ton of money and his job for quite a while. He was out. He actually went to prison. And when he got out, he started not just donating a lot of money, but doing volunteer work at animal shelters and showing up for all these events. And as near as I could tell, demonstrating that he really had seen the error of his ways and changed. And he got a job back, and, you know, in football, and now he has a job with Fox as a commentator, you know, for football. And that seems to be like a redemption story. So that can happen, but it doesn't happen ever, as far as I can tell, and it's not going to happen ever, with the wildfire speed of the initial condemnations of the mob,
mm-hmm.
because that can happen literally in a matter of an hour. Something can go national or international in an hour, and it may take you months or years to redeem yourself and get everybody to notice.
Absolutely. And as you say, man, there's no easy answers. I guess to me, this is just a cautionary tale for all of us who use social media to, you know, you don't get extra internet points for being the first to retweet something. You don't get extra internet points for being the first to post on Facebook or even to be the angriest response. You don't get any extra points. There are no prizes to be redeemed. You don't get a pony.
There's no prize, there's no pony, but also, and this is the sad part of it, you aren't rewarded for being the first person in a case like that coffee shop thing to come up and respond with a post going, hold on, wait a minute, this doesn't look right. Now, that's not going to get 40,000 tweets because the original story was so much juicier.
That is true.
The same vicious circle before.
That is true, which is, you know, why, again, I mean, I don't think the answer is going to be found in legislation. I don't think the Slow Down the Internet Act of 2018 is going to do anything so that it takes you 20 minutes to actually tweet something out. I think the answer, as difficult it is within us. I mean, it's self-control. It is wanting to know the facts before you immediately respond. And as you say, that is antithetical to how social media works. So, I mean, you almost have to prepare yourself. If you want to be a good consumer of information, you almost have to steel yourself to the fact that you're likely to be bad at social media.
Yes, and I'm particularly bad at social media unless I'm talking about horseradish or drinking.
But you know what? You're going to make
harvesting the horseradish this week.
Oh, fantastic. You're going to make a great spokesperson for the Washington, D.C. Convention and Visitors Bureau, though.
I may sign up for that.
Come to D.C. and, you know, stay for a day. Jazz.
Just a day, yes.
Just a day. No longer than that. Hey, buddy, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. I do appreciate it, and good luck with harvesting the horseradish.
Oh, yeah, I'll be on that as soon as I get back home. Thank you, sir.
All right, man, we'll talk to you soon. Jazz Shaw with us here on Cam and Company. We got 7 pounds of Carolina Reaper peppers in the mail today from one of the listeners to the 40 Acre and a Fool podcast. There will be a new podcast, by the way, coming up later in the week. We've had guests this weekend, so we've not been able to do one. But did you know, Cameron, that you can mail 7 pounds of Carolina Reaper peppers?
I did not know that, Ed.
I didn't either. I kind of figured, you know, the hazardous material warning would kick in at like 5 pounds or so. But, yes, I believe still the hottest peppers known to man. And my wife is going to be pickling them and turning them into hot sauce. I'm kind of scared. I'll be honest with you. I'm kind of scared. We will not have a hot sauce made entirely of the Carolina Reaper peppers because that's just crazy. That's insane. That's probably a lawsuit just waiting to happen. And I'm lucky enough to be able to talk to Kurt Schlichter on a regular basis without being charged an hourly fee, but that would probably require an hourly fee. But we're going to add it into the rest of the hot sauce that we're making with the habaneros and the we've got some Thai chilies. We've got some lemon peppers, which are really pleasant to look at and are just taste like the sun. So, yeah. This is going to be a fun, exciting weekend. Jazz doing, maybe we'll send Jazz a bottle of hot sauce for some homemade horseradish. All right, when we come back, Robert Verbruggen from National Review with a piece at National Review on reducing gun violence. Because, you know, again, at the end of the day, I don't think Americans certainly split on the issue of do we want more gun control? Do we want to protect our right to keep and bear arms? I don't think that there's a big split on the question of do you want less violent crime? I think the vast majority of Americans say, yes, I do. The question is, how do you get there? Do you get there through laws that are aimed at reducing the scope of the Second Amendment? Do you get there through laws that are aimed at restricting what legal gun owners can do? Or do you get there to that safer society, those safer communities, safer individual streets, by actually focusing on the bad actors who live and prey on the people who live on those streets and in those neighborhoods and in those communities? We'll talk about it again with Robert Verbruggen of National Review right after a quick break. So stick around. There's much more Cam and Company still to come.
I'm talking with Cole McCullough, the NRA's Director of Competitive Shooting. Cole, how are you, sir?
Hey, how are you doing, Cam? Good to see you.
It is good to see you. And tell me a little bit about what the competitive shooting division is all about at NRA. I know there's some big matches that most gun owners know about, but the NRA is responsible for thousands of matches around the country every year.
Yes, sir. There's over 11,000, you know, nationwide, worldwide. So it's every different type of shooting, from small bore through action style shooting or Bianchi Cup or NRA national matches. It's far and wide.
And all across all disciplines. So how do you manage all of that? How do you even wrap your head around everything that the competitive shooting division encompasses?
Well, isn't that the question? It really is. That's the thing. It's the good thing is, you know, in the past, you know, 4 or 5 months since I've been here, it gives us a chance to take a fresh look at everything. You know, from the national matches being separated instead of being all at Camp Perry, that was a very new thing for us, and it was not a lot of time to get to it, and a lot of people did some great things to make it happen. But when we take a look at what is really a new shooter and what is a competitive shooter, it's not just the 18-year-old, 19-year-old junior shooter. It's somebody that's 50 or 60 saying, I can still do this stuff. And so we're trying to break down any paradigms or other stereotypes that might be on that, look at the sports that are being productive, really. Transition from peacemakers helped me to see a lot of that and have some opinions. And good thing is NRA is really backing us, and we're looking forward to a great new chapter in shooting sports.
So if someone is interested in competitive shooting, but they've never actually done it, maybe they've gone to the range or gun owners, but they just don't know how to make that move, what's your advice?
One, be safe. And take the training, become that responsible gun-owning citizen. That is very, very important. And once you've done that, or you need more appropriate training, you know, then go ahead and start in your local club matches. A lot of matches run around the United States in a variety of disciplines really have great instructors, great other shooters, good match directors, and you'll know the right ones. You'll get a good sense of feel for that and how open people are. So I'd say you start at the local levels, get your training, make sure you're safe, and then it's nothing that you can't do. I mean, it's the thing. Go have the courage to go out and have a good time. NRA is always on standby. You need some advice, give us a call. We'll help you.
And this is a really welcoming sport, by the way. I mean, I think if people are worried that, okay, you know, I'm not going to be very good, people are going to laugh, they're going to, you know, call me a newbie, that's not going to happen. I mean, you've got so many gun owners who are just excited to see a new face out there and somebody who is willing to give it a try.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, and when we talk about competitive shooting, the variety of shooting is enormous. So if you just think of an athlete, for example, you may be a soccer player, for example. That doesn't make you a great skier, right? As shooting sports is just like that. You may shoot rifle. It doesn't make you a great pistol shooter. For the first time this year, I didn't even have the right gun. I went to Camp Perry, and I shot a big, huge boat anchor of a steel challenge gun that was 7 inches long. I could hardly hold it on the target. But I went and shot it, and I got through it, and it was a great time. So was I a new shooter? No, but I was a new shooter to that. And so the thing is, you can come right out, have that courage and fun. As long as you're safe, it's not like that. It's not so competitive to the point you can't do it. It's a great thing. You'll find this whole new part of life you might be able to enjoy and have a good time regardless of your age.
Absolutely. That's another key. I mean, you talked about, you know, these new shooters are not just junior shooters. You can get into competitive shooting in your 40s, 50s, 60s,
absolutely,
and you can be really good.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the thing. It's the American responsible gun-owning civilian that are the dominant shooters in the world. The World Shooting Championship shows that. Where do they come from? They're niche specialists, and they train in these areas, and they set the bar time and again, time and again. Of course, there's groups like the Army Marksmanship Unit, and they have something to say about that, but they're professional trained competition shooters. The idea is that the free American gun owner, responsible gun owner, they are the ones. And a lot of people get started much later in life. So can you still be a champion? You start when you're 40 or 50? Yes, you can.
Talking again with Cole McCullough, the Director of Competitive Shooting for the National Rifle Association. So where's the best way for folks to get more information about everything that division encompasses? Are you all on the NRA's website?
Yes, we are. You can just go ahead and Google NRA Competitive Shooting Sports Division. We have a whole series of web pages. We have a Competitive Shooting Division Facebook. Facebook as well, where we're constantly posting all different types of articles and YouTube videos about what's going on, how to get involved. But certainly that, you know, the NRA Competitive Shooting website and the NRA Competitive Shooting Division Facebook that's out there are great ways to get in touch with us.
Absolutely. Cole, listen, thanks again for everything that you do. Yes, and all of the volunteers and the staffers there in the Competitive Shooting Division. This is one of the many areas of the NRA that doesn't get a lot of mainstream media focus, but it is vitally important to the future of our Second Amendment. So, Cole McCullough, thank you for spending some time with us here. Cole McCullough, Director of the NRA's Competitive Shooting Division, joining us here on Cam and Company.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Thanks again for being a part of the program. Top of the hour, we have today's heroes of the day, deal of the day, good guy as well. Right now, I want to welcome from National Review, Deputy Managing Editor Robert Verbruggen is with us on Twitter at R.A. Verbruggen. Robert, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program, and I appreciate your article in National Review, Reducing Gun Violence, Suggestions That Do Not Involve Gun Control. And you know, it's Robert, it's so interesting, and I'm glad that you've written about this, because one of the things that you write, you say, quietly over the past two decades, criminologists, community groups, and technology companies have hit upon strategies that can reduce the bloodshed without infringing on anyone's right to bear arms. And you're right, and yet so rarely does this come up, right? We spend so much time and energy talking about things like universal background check laws, when even studies done by gun control advocates say, they're not really that effective. The things that are effective, the things that aren't gun control laws, they struggle to even get attention or to get notice in the broader media.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think a lot of times we're so eager to jump in and start fighting about these sort of culture war type of issues and these really hot button political issues, that sometimes we forget that there are these strategies out there that work and that have been tested and that have been studied that aren't as controversial and that don't involve, you know, Republican versus Democratic fights, and it just involves, you know, getting down into the situation and figuring out what's going on and working to stop these things from happening.
So you write that the fundamental insight is that violence is incredibly concentrated. You say the broad demographic disparities are fairly well known. Young men with a peak around age 20 commit murder at highly disproportionate rates. There's a severe racial gap with a homicide rate for blacks about eight times what it is for non-Hispanic whites. The poor are overrepresented as well among perpetrators and victims alike, as are people with criminal records. But you say those are really broad generalizations. You say the patterns get a lot more specific than that. Particular neighborhoods, blocks, and intersections even, where crime most often occurs. And these are, again, these are crimes that are committed by real individuals, not crimes that are committed by a data point. These are people, mm-hmm, who are typically known to those in the community. Typically, they're known to law enforcement as well, are they not?
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things I've seen in researching this, is that there's actually a study where the researcher looked at people who were arrested together. So this isn't, you know, they weren't going on Twitter and seeing who's following everybody else to figure out the social networks. They restricted the inquiry to who got arrested together. And just by doing that, he was able to put together a social network where he found 70% of the gunshot victims there within that social network, within these sort of small social networks. Less than 6% of the city's population contains 70% of the non-fatal gunshot victims. So if you look at the data that all police departments already have and the social networks that these people operate in, the criminals operate in, you can actually identify a very large percentage of people who are going to be involved in this violence and focus your resources on them. And I think that's a really valuable insight that I don't think a lot of police departments are taking full advantage of.
Absolutely. And as you write, I mean, not only are you dealing with the individuals, but also dealing with those specific geographic locations. You say one simple strategy is to police those hot spots, right? That 5% of the street corners in Boston, where nearly 74% of the city's shootings occurred over a 30-year period. I mean, that's pretty amazing. So you can identify those individuals, you can identify those geographic locations that spawn more violence. And what happens when you, let's say, flood those zones, or not even flood the zones, Robert, but there's a reliable police presence near those hot spots? What happens? Does the crime just go somewhere else?
It doesn't, actually. That's one of the more interesting things is you might expect to see, you know, the crime fall there, but increase in the bordering areas. But that's actually a very consistent finding of the research is that it doesn't just go somewhere else. You actually do seem to have just this effect where you cut down on the crime without spreading it elsewhere. It seems that, you know, for whatever reason, there's, you know, people concentrated here or, you know, a drug trade concentrated here, whatever the case is, that when you take care of that problem and make sure that the police are keeping an eye on the area, you can actually bring down crime without just spreading it elsewhere.
Okay, so imagine these things done in conjunction with one another, right? Where it's not just, well, we'll adopt one of these strategies, but you've got, you know, officers and investigators who are identifying the most violent gang in the country or in the city, and the most violent gang members within that gang, starting there. Meanwhile, you're policing those hot spots. And cities around the country, this isn't a hypothetical, right? Cities around the country have done this, and they've seen results.
Yeah, if you look at my article, I cited some research reviews where they routed up all the different studies on these things. And these are things that have been tried in a lot of different places. Sometimes they've been tried in a very scientific manner where they randomly assign certain areas to be policed in these ways so they can really nail down what the effect of the program is. And these are the ones that they've found have been very effective. These are things that can reduce crime by a third or by half if they're implemented well.
You say implemented well, and that does seem to be a key. The devil's in the details. And there have been places that have tried to implement this. David Kennedy had a book that came out a few years ago called Don't Shoot, where he talked about cities implementing the ceasefire program and how they were very effective in some cities. And in some cities, you know, interagency politics got in the way. Elected officials, politicking got in the way. What are some of the major hurdles to implementing policies, and why don't we see more of an emphasis on this? Why are we still talking about things like, quote unquote, universal background checks or other, measures that aren't really even aimed at violent criminals?
I mean, I think one problem that, you know, anytime you have any sort of program like this, you need good people to run it. And when good people leave, you need to find a good replacement for them. So I think these kind of programs require an ongoing attention. The people in charge of them need to be paying attention to the program and making sure that everything is running correctly. And I think that just slips over time, unfortunately. I think you see that a lot of times. You know, you'll have a lot of success with the program, and then it, you know, will fall apart. And another problem, you know, sometimes these programs are sometimes run by law enforcement. Sometimes they're run in conjunction with law enforcement. And in some of these programs, even though they seem fairly effective, law enforcement has problems with certain aspects of it. You know, Chicago's ceasefire program is an example. It used ex-offenders to go out and talk to people who are at risk of violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in one of the messages they even sent out was, you know, we want to be your first call. Call us and we'll, you know, mediate the dispute and make sure that nothing happens here. And a lot of times police, you know, sort of chafe at that. It's, you know, partly I think a territorial thing, and also just partly that, you know, police, their job is to arrest people. So if you have a program that's taking ex-offenders and putting them out into your turf, I think that you know, some people chafe at that. So there's a lot of issues when it comes to implementing these programs correctly, but I think it's something that, since they've been shown to be so effective, I think it's something that we really need to start looking at very carefully.
Absolutely. Robert, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's good talking with you today.
You too. Thanks so much.
You bet. Robert Verbruggen joining us, the Deputy Managing Editor at National Review with us here on Cam and Company. You know, I do understand what Robert was saying about the like the ceasefire program and objections, but I think maybe the bigger objection is the vetting process. Yes, when you're dealing with ex-offenders, do they provide that street cred in talking with individuals who are currently in a gang? And being able to say, listen, I was where you were, right, a couple of years ago, and I've changed, and I'm not where you are now. And you don't need to be where you are now either. Sure. I imagine that added credibility is going to be effective. But we've also seen in Chicago and elsewhere these interventionists, these former gang members who are, you know, part of the ceasefire program, they really aren't former gang members. They're still very much involved in criminal activity. including dealing drugs, including selling illegal guns that are possessed illegally, stolen firearms. That happened in Chicago not long ago, involved in shootings. I mean, heck, you had in L.A., this was several years ago, a group that was funded to the tune of millions of dollars by the city of Los Angeles. It was called No Guns. And again, it was such a heartwarming story. Hector Marroquin, a former gang member, turning his life around, now dedicating himself, getting his family involved in this enterprise to keep young men away from the gangs. And he was lauded. He was praised. City leaders would show up to take their picture with him. And then he got busted for illegally selling guns to undercover ATF officers. And Hector Marroquin and No Guns went away. Hector went away to prison. No Guns just kind of disappeared into the ether there. Big Weasel was Hector's name. His son, Little Weasel, went to prison too, if I recall correctly, in that case. But, you know, that is, I think, a genuine concern. Yes, on the one hand, again, you want those individuals who have that life experience that can actually reach these young men who are in gangs. But you do need to vet these individuals because you don't want those individuals using their new position to further their own criminal enterprises. And, you know, you've got to be realistic to the fact that there may very well be some individuals who would try to do exactly that. But it doesn't, to me, negate the success of programs that, again, focus on those most violent offenders. And, again, focus on those violent areas. I was really interested to read that in Robert's piece about 74% of Boston's shootings occurring on less than 5% of its street corners and block faces. Over 30 years. I mean, so that's not just, you know, a snapshot of, you know, 1 month, where did this occur? 30-year period. 5% of the city's blocks and corners are where you could find 74% of the homicides. Now, again, I suppose Massachusetts could pass a law that would restrict the Second Amendment rights even further of the remaining legal gun owners in the state. Or what happened, what would happen if the city of Boston were to double the patrols in that 5% of the city where 74% of the shootings took place over 30 years? What would happen if the city of Boston were to really engage in community policing efforts so that the cops that worked in that district or in those districts where the 5% of the city where 74% of the shootings are taking place, if they got out of their cars, if they got to know the people in the community, if the people in the community got to know the cops who are patrolling their neighborhoods, what kind of impact could that have the next time there is a shooting? Whereas now, you might have officers roll up and nobody saw anything, even though there were, you know, 12, 14 people outside. Strangely enough, everyone was looking the wrong way. No eyewitnesses. Would you be able to find two or three individuals who would say, I know that officer. I talked to that officer a couple weeks ago. I've seen him around here. He stops and we chat when I see him. You know what? I'm going to tell him what I know. Probably wouldn't impact, again, 100% of the people in those neighborhoods. But it might impact enough. And when you get that cooperation from the community, then you can, as a law enforcement officer, build a case that can put these people behind bars. And if you are a good person living in a bad neighborhood, you may want the best for all these young men who are running around making your street such an awful place to live. You may want them to turn their life around, but if they're not going to turn their life around, you would at least like them to go away. Because if they're gone, then maybe your kids can play outside again. Again, if they stop what they're doing, your kids can play outside again. But if they won't do that, and that's their decision, if you know that the law is there, and you know that there are going to be repercussions for those criminal acts, you know that if you speak up, justice will be done, guess what? More people will speak up. All right, we've only got about 60 seconds left here in this hour of Cam and Company. Coming up next hour, our hero of the day, actually two today, plus our deal of the day, good guy as well. Tim Lee joins us from the Center for Individual Freedom with a Liberty update. Probably talk a little college football as well. Laura Carno from Coloradans for Civil Liberties. She'll be with us talking about the Colorado governor's race. It's not until next year. But you've got, at last count, I believe, nine gubernatorial candidates in Colorado. And at issue, one of the big issues for all of those running, the gun control laws put in place in Colorado by outgoing Governor John Hickenlooper in 2013. And the fact that these laws don't really seem to be doing much to actually make Colorado safer. Stick around. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's coming up right after this.
Talking with Kevin Dixie from No Other Choice Firearms Training. Kevin, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. So tell me about No Other Choice Firearms Training.
The philosophy behind the training company is this. No Other Choice is just that. So we go out, we want to train people, get them protecting themselves, understanding what the Second Amendment is. However, before you ever use that skill set, no matter what you learn in class, you ever use anything, whether it be a bat, gun, car, against anybody else, you should be at a point of no other choice. You tried to run from the situation, talk your way out of the situation, avoid it altogether and never be there before you ever think about impacting a human life, even if they so quote-unquote deserve it, make sure you're at a point of no other choice.
You know, and it's I'm glad that you're emphasizing that, because one of, I think, the misconceptions that we have about concealed carry holders, about gun owners in general, is that we're all a bunch of trigger-happy nuts, right? Who are just looking for an excuse to whip out our gun, when that is the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, if we're ever in a position where you have to defend your life, I don't know about you, Kevin, I never want to be in that position where I have to defend my life.
Right. I've been carrying a gun almost 20 years now, and I've never had to deploy that gun. Now, I've had to deploy it in my form of work before, as far as a defensive tool to do my job, but I've never had to actually discharge a firearm against another human being, because they've always made the smart option of, hey, okay, this is one too far, let's stop. So I disagree with that. I mean, how many people are carrying guns today? And nobody's getting hurt, right? I think concealed carriers are some of the best people walking the face of the earth, because they have godlike power, and they respect it more than anything else. So it's totally false.
So how did you get into gun ownership? How did you get into firearms training?
I was working at the St. Louis City Police Department. I worked in the jail division, and I saw a lot of individuals that were making, good people making bad choices. Well, along with that job came a lot of firearms exposure and training and things like that. So I decided to kind of blend two things. I took the training opportunities, got into guns, started understanding my rights a lot more at the age of 21, and then I also wanted to train people not only to defend themselves against the guys I was working with every day, but also help people that were just making bad decisions to make better decisions, you know, so they're not in situations. So that went to training. Let's teach you how to defend yourself and be safe against some of the evil people in the world, but let's also prevent you from becoming a person that's a good person but making mistakes, and let's blend the two. And that's how it started.
You know, in St. Louis itself, where you're based, right, and you look at Chicago, you look at St. Louis, you look even in places like New York City or Washington, D.C., Baltimore, you got a lot of violent crime, but you don't have, I think, a cultural or a political push towards responsible gun ownership. It's almost the other direction. They don't want anybody to be gun owners, as opposed to wanting to make sure that training is available for anybody who wants to become a legal gun owner.
Correct. And the reason for that is because guns are polarizing, right? It's a polarizing subject, and a lot of people want to work on the emotion of the community. They want, you know, if you walk outside every day and your situation isn't the best, cosmetically your area isn't the best, it's easy for me to play on your emotions, right, and tell you that, hey, these guys are bad, trust me, let me defend you. And what I'm trying to tell people is, let's get you out, let's show you what life is, let's help you out with resources. Once you understand what you're working for, please understand that there is somebody walking this earth that will take that from you in a blink of an eye. So instead of trying to depower you to trust me, I want to empower you for you can protect everything you work hard for. And so whether it's in your current situation or you just want to work hard to get out of your situation, you need to understand you have to have the power to protect yourself, regardless of what somebody politically is trying to drive you to. Understand, take your own responsibility. It's safe, it's fun, it's the ultimate equalizer, and everybody that does it has a level of respect that is ungodly, and you need to understand that and just take it upon yourself.
So 10 seconds or less, Kevin, who is showing up for your training sessions these days?
Everybody. I teach and train everybody, but I have seen a great big push in women, and I love it, women, and I'm getting a lot more anti-gunners in, so it's always fun for me.
Wow, how about that? Kevin Dixie. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. If folks want more information, where can they get it?
You can look on Facebook at NOC for No Other Choice Firearms Training. You can also look me up, Kevin Dixie, D-I-X-I-E. That's on Facebook, and on Instagram it's at NOC Firearms Training, all one word.
Kevin Dixie with No Other Choice Firearms Training here on Cam and Company.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company starts right this second here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. On the program this hour, Hero of the Day. Heroes, actually. Deal of the Day. Good guy today. Plus Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. Laura Carno with Coloradans for Civil Liberties. And more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. Right now, though, let's get to today's Heroes of the Day, brought to you by Adcor Defense. First story from Highland Park, Michigan, where police say a concealed carry holder shot and killed a man who shot at him and others early Saturday in Highland Park. Police say two men were in a car in the parking lot of a Sunoco gas station. Police say another car with one person inside pulled up. It was around midnight and began talking with the men in the first car. Police say two men then walked out of a field and began shooting at the men in the cars. The man in the first car, or a man in that first car, who is a CPL holder, shot and killed one of the shooters. According to Click on Detroit, police say if that man had not returned fire, they believe all of the people in the two cars may have been killed. The dead gunman, the CPL holder, according to Click on Detroit, both in their 20s. Police are looking for the second attacker. A black male, standing about 5'9", dressed in black clothing with a hood over his head. So not much of a description to go on. But that CPL holder, able to kill one of those attackers, defend himself and others there in Highland Park. We'll try to give you an update if one becomes available and that second arrest is made. Meanwhile, our second hero of the day from KTVB, Channel 7 in Airway Heights, Washington. This defensive gun use, like most defensive gun uses around the country, did not result in the trigger being pulled, but an Army veteran, Jonathan Kiner, able to protect himself and his family. And I tell you what, rather than me explain this story, I just want to share with you, courtesy of KTVB, their local report on Army combat veteran Jonathan Kiner and his defensive gun use. Take a look and a listen.
After serving 6 years in the Army, combat veteran Jonathan Kiner never thought he would pull his gun on anyone ever again.
And I just put myself in front of the danger.
That was until Thursday evening. Kiner and his family were grocery shopping at the Walmart in Airway Heights. They paid and walked out to their SUV and started loading it up. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary until Kiner walked over to the driver's side.
That's when the door popped open and he was sitting in there. And everything escalated from there.
The strange man tried to bolt from the car, but Kiner was able to get a hold of him.
I said, "Do not fight me." I said, "I don't want to hurt you." But the safety of my family was first and foremost.
The safety of his family, again, was at stake, and Jonathan Kiner able to protect his family. He said he tried to struggle a little bit. I got him to the ground. He kind of just balled up into a turtle position, and I held him there and held him down. Airway Heights police identifying the man as Jared Austin. He was arrested, cited for misdemeanor second-degree vehicle prowling. Kiner, by the way, says he showed police his concealed carry license, and he was free to go. He said, though, going through this, it stuck with him. He said, unfortunately, it brought a lot of bad things back from when I was over in Iraq. He said, we dealt with a lot of people in situations that were like that. And Jonathan Kiner didn't just keep this in. He reached out to the Spokane Veterans Outreach Center and talked to them about what he was going through, what he was thinking. He said, they were there for me yesterday. They were there for me today. So I thank them very much. They're a very good organization. Jonathan Kiner said that's not the only thing that he's thankful for. He said, I was also thankful that it happened to me, and I had the skills and knowledge to ascertain the situation where I didn't need to use deadly force. There was no reason to. He says that he hopes that he has never faced
with another situation that forces him to pull his firearm again. Again, I don't know the concealed carry holder who wakes up and says, I hope today's the day I get to use my gun in self-defense. Any more than I don't know anybody who has car insurance who says, I hope today's the day I get in a wreck. Or I hope today's the day I get to use the fire extinguisher in my kitchen. It's not really what it's about. Those of us who are concealed carry holders, like Jonathan Kiner, we hope we never have to pull our firearm. And I'm with him. I hope he never has to pull his firearm again. But I'm glad that he was able to protect himself and his family. And he is today's second hero of the day. Our deal of the day. From the Oregonian in Portland. Bethany Barnes reporting. Portland police officers have arrested a man who broke into Cleveland High and set trash cans on fire in connection with a shooting that happened in the Selwood neighborhood on Thursday. Now, these are two separate incidents here. Devin Julkowski, who's 20, he was arrested on Saturday after a shooting. According to the Oregonian, police zeroed in on Julkowski because officers believe the shooter drove a 2000 Burgundy Honda Accord. They located such a car on Saturday morning and arrested Julkowski. Officers searched the car. They found a firearm. He's been booked into the Multnomah County Jail on charges of assault in the first degree, as well as felon in possession of a firearm. It was back in May of this year, just a few months ago, that Mr. Julkowski pleaded guilty to second-degree arson and second-degree burglary. He and another man broke into the public high school, set trash cans on fire, and posted the crime on Snapchat on a school day, early before the start of classes. He was sentenced to a whopping 2 years of probation for this. The Oregonian says, he was supposed to undergo mental health, drug, and alcohol treatment if such treatment was deemed necessary. It was not immediately clear if he got treatment. And it certainly is clear that he got a slap on the wrist because just a few months after taking that plea bargain, Devin Julkowski, now arrested, charged with assault in the first degree and felon in possession of a firearm. The cynical part of me says we'll see what he gets to plead guilty to this time around. But hopefully we will not see another sweetheart deal for today's deal of the day, Devin Julkowski of Portland, Oregon. And our good guy of the day today from Florida, Pembroke Pines, Florida. Thursday afternoon, there was a car crash. It was a rush hour. Driver of a white Chevy Cavalier tried to turn, colliding with a Dodge Charger. Driver of the Charger, an off-duty Florida Department of Law Enforcement officer. And Travis Wilson was nearby. He heard the crash. He said his military instinct kicked in, and he ran to help. Travis Wilson is homeless. He was applying for housing with an organization called Operation Sacred Trust, and he was going through his interview when he heard a loud bang. Seth Eisenberg with Operation Sacred Trust said in the split second, he said, I think, you know, somebody may need help. And he got up and he left. He ran about a block to the scene. He said, I just turned it on and I went sprinting to the vehicle. Cell phone video at the scene, it showed Wilson reaching into the Chevy Cavalier and stabilizing the driver's head. He said it's like putting a neck collar on him to stop him from moving their neck. He said it's just instinct. He stayed there until paramedics arrived. He said, I can't leave the scene. He said, it doesn't matter if the vehicle catches on fire. It doesn't matter. If I'm there with them, if we're going to die, we're going to die together. Police say the driver of that Cavalier taken to a local hospital with life-threatening injuries. The off-duty law enforcement officer suffering minor injuries, and Travis Wilson, a U.S. Navy corpsman in the early 1990s, coming to the aid of a stranger. We thank him for being in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. And we hope that life smiles on Travis Wilson. I imagine that the extra attention that Mr. Wilson is getting, hopefully, will allow him not only to find a place to live, but a place of employment and whatever else he needs to get back on his feet. But he is today's good guy of the day. All right, as I mentioned, still to come, we have Mr. Tim Lee joining us from the Center for Individual Freedom. Also, later in the hour, Laura Carno will join us on the program. This week, by the way, on NRA TV, Chuck Holton is in San Diego. And you can tune in to Stinchfield Mornings on NRA TV to take a look at what Chuck is able to see firsthand there. This is the week that the prototypes for the new border wall are supposed to be completed. And Chuck is there on the ground reporting. We've got a sneak peek from Chuck. Take a look at a listen.
Progress is being made on President Trump's plan to build a much more substantial barrier along the U.S. southern border. These eight prototypes, each approaching 30 feet tall, are taking shape in the desert outside of San Diego. Once completed, CBP will evaluate them and decide which is best. They want one which is hard to scale, hard to penetrate, and hard to tunnel under. The bigger issue is how it will get paid for. Some estimates put the cost at $25 billion, and the plan faces tough opposition from Democrats and some Republicans. In other words, it's not what these contractors do that matters, but what Congress does. The number of illegals entering the U.S. is down sharply this year simply because the president signaled a much tougher stance against them. Ironically, this decline now has many politicians saying there's no need for a wall. We'll be reporting from San Diego this week on the ongoing controversy, so stay tuned. I'm Chuck Holton for NRA TV.
And again, you can catch Chuck's reports on NRA TV throughout the week from San Diego. Savannah, Georgia. I thought this was pretty interesting. The Savannah Area Republican Women's Club hosting a weekend event, Ladies, Guns, and Ammo. The Chatham County Sheriff's Office teaching this course at the local shooting range. Now, I was kind of curious as to what the turnout for an event like this would be there in Savannah, Georgia. Apparently, it was packed. Dozens of women, they say, showed up for this event. And this was, again, designed and geared towards women who didn't have a lot of experience, maybe had no experience with firearms, but a place to go out in a safe and welcoming and inviting location to learn. Elizabeth Overton, who's the past president of the Savannah Area Republican Women's Club, says we've talked about doing it. But the president finally got it together by working with the sheriff. She said, with all that's going on, we wanted the women to be able to take care of themselves, and learning how to shoot a gun and not be afraid of it's very important to all of us. It takes away your fear because you know that you can defend yourself. You know, isn't that interesting? It takes away your fear. I mean, this is one of the things that we're told by anti-gun advocates all the time, right? That the only reason why you own a firearm is because you're afraid. And if you weren't afraid, then you wouldn't be a gun owner. And yet, here's an actual gun owner saying, you know, this actually took away that fear that I had because now I feel confident that I can protect myself. This, by the way, this was done in conjunction with the local Republican Women's Club, but the sheriff's office actually does this in the Savannah, Georgia area twice a month. They have these classes. Lieutenant Gary Murphy says everybody that buys a gun should learn how to use it safely and correctly to be a responsible gun owner, and this is a good class to take in order to achieve it. I agree. It's too bad that there are so many, quote-unquote, gun safety advocates around the country. I'm sorry, common-sense gun safety advocates around the country who disagree, who are upset by the fact that there were dozens of women there in the Savannah, Georgia area who were out at that sheriff's event this weekend. Because, again, their idea of gun safety is not, well, go take a class and go to a range and learn how to be safe and responsible, feel empowered, be empowered. Mm-mm. No, their idea of gun safety is don't own a gun. Got that down and you're good to go, right? It's interesting. I was looking at a piece in the New York Post today by the former CEO of NPR on what the left gets wrong when it comes to gun ownership. This former CEO of NPR took a year off, apparently, and decided to travel around the country doing things that he would not normally do as the CEO of NPR. So he said, I stood in pit row at a NASCAR race. He said, I hung out at Tea Party meetings. I sat in on Steve Bannon's radio show. He said, I found an America far different from the one depicted in the press and imagined by presidents clinging to guns or religion and presidential candidates, basket of deplorables alike. He said, I spent many Sundays in evangelical churches. I hung out with 15,000 evangelical youth. I wasn't sure what to expect among thousands of college-age evangelicals, but I certainly didn't expect the intense discussion of racial equity and refugee issues, even though that's what I got. He said, early this year, I drove west from Houston, Texas, to Gonzales to try my hand at pig hunting. He says it was my first time with a gun, and the noticeably concerned owner at the ranch at first banished me to a solitary spot on the grounds. Here, he said, the pigs would come to me, and I could not pose a danger to anybody else. He said it was a nice spot, but it didn't make for much of a story, so I wandered off into the woods, hopefully protected by my day-glow hunting vest. Eventually, he hooked up with other hunters. He got a chance to spend some time with them. He said, in the afternoon, with his group from Georgia heading home, he said, I linked up with a group of friends from Houston who belied the demographic stereotyping hunters. Collectively, we were the equivalent, he writes, of a bad bar joke. A Hispanic ex-soldier, a young black family man, a Serbian immigrant, and a Jew from D.C. And yet, there they all were. All hunting. He said, none of my new hunting partners fit the lazy caricature of the angry NRA member. Rather, he says, they saw guns as both a shared sport and a necessary means to protect their families during uncertain times. In truth, he says, the only one who was even modestly angry was me, and that only had to do with my terrible ineptness as a hunter. He said, in the end, though, I did bag a pig, or at least my new friends were willing to award me a kill so that we could all glory together in the fraternity of the hunt. He said, over the course of this past year, I've tried to consume media as they do. Not as NPR listeners do, but as the other side does. And to understand it as a partisan player, he says it's not so hard to do. Take guns. He says gun control and gun rights, one of our most divisive issues, and there are legitimate points on both sides. But the media, he says, is obsessed with the gun control side and gives only scant, mostly negative recognition to the gun rights side. Take, for example, he said, the issue of defensive gun uses, which is often dismissed by the media as a myth, but they happen all the time. 200 times a day, according to the Department of Justice, or 5,000 times a day, according to an overly exuberant Florida State University study. But whatever study you choose to believe, defensive gun uses, he writes, do happen frequently. And give credence, he says, to my hunting friends who see their guns as the last line of defense for themselves and their families. He says it's not that the media is suppressing these stories intentionally. It's that these stories don't reflect their interests and beliefs. He said, it's why my new friends in Youngstown, Ohio, and Pikeville, Kentucky see the media as hopelessly disconnected from their lives, and it's how the media has opened the door to charges of bias. Well, again, not just open the doors. They haven't just left themselves open to these charges of bias. Many of them are now reveling in it. This was Ken Stern. He has a book coming out tomorrow, Republican Like Me, How I Left the Liberal Bubble and Learned to Love the Right. Interesting. I might actually read this based on his column in the New York Post, because I got to tell you, this is probably the most neutral position on the Second Amendment that I've ever heard from anybody at NPR. Right? All right, when we come back, Tim Lee joins us with the Center for Individual Freedom, Laura Carno, later in the hour. More of the day's top Second Amendment news and information headed your way right after a quick timeout.
I'm here with Eric Lipp with the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. Tell us, what is the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program? What's it all about?
Well, it's real easy. It's a firearm accident prevention program for young kids. Everything we focus on is centered around one easy message. If you see a gun, stop, don't touch, run away, and tell a grown-up. Pre-K through fourth grade is our base. You know, we want to start educating as soon as really kids start to show an interest, just like any other safety object.
So Eddie Eagle's got some history. He's been around a while, and he's been doing this really well for a long time. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, he's quite got some age on him. He's going to be 30 next year.
Wow.
So he's been around a while. Just got a little facelift, if you want to say. He's looking real fresh these days.
Yep.
In the past year. So he's been around a long time. He's done over 29 million kids in that time period. Over 26,000 police departments, schools,
wow,
civic groups that have used our program. So we have a ton of history.
Over 29 million kids. How many
yep.
school program?
Over 26,000 different schools, law enforcement agencies, and civic groups.
It's amazing. And you guys get in there, and you're part of the community. You do this with different schools, like you said, law
Absolutely.
Enforcement agencies. It's really integral into, you know, in this part of being part of the community. It's awesome. So what's a good reason for folks who are watching or listening? Why should they check out the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program?
I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. We're a safety program. Everyone wants safety of kids is important to everybody. Firearms are found in, you know, 40% or higher of U.S. homes, and it's just a just like there's going to be talks about, you know, you don't talk to strangers or you, talks about matches and stuff like that. It is a something that you just want to educate your kids about, and we strictly focus on education. We're not here to talk about the NRA or firearms or whether they're good or bad, just that, you know, it's a fact of life. And right now you want to make sure you're teaching your kids.
How to get more information?
Real easy. Go to www.eddieeagle.com. All the kids' stuff is right there. If you're a parent and want some more information about, you know, how to talk to your own kids or even how to talk to your other parents in your neighborhood, we have another page. You hit the grown-up button, and you're right there for all that information.
Last summer, five Dallas law enforcement officers were killed while protecting hundreds of protesters who marched against America's police. My brother, Mike Kroll, was one of them. No protesters lost their lives. No media were hit by bullets. But Mike was there, protecting, serving, sacrificing, as he did every day for 8 years on the Dallas PD. The National Rifle Association honors such sacrifice. While the media paints our police as criminals and celebrities attack them, the NRA backs our blue. Now you can too. Donate your vehicles to NRA Cars for Freedom. Visit NRACarsForFreedom.com or call 1-866-NRA-GIFT. Donations are tax deductible and will help provide training for law enforcement. My brother gave his life protecting those who marched against him. That's why I back our blue. Stand with me. NRACarsForFreedom.com. 1-866-NRA-GIFT.
For the land of the free and the home of the brave. From high school gyms to towering stadiums, every time I see our flag wave, I feel a humbling reminder of the brave who keep and have kept us free. I stand to honor the sacrifices of the generations before me. Heroes who charged into battle through bombs and bullets, who lost their brothers and still pushed through, fighting for every inch of our freedom. I stand for my brothers who can't stand anymore. Men who hunted terrorists to the ends of the earth, who sacrificed their bodies and their lives so that we could peacefully live ours. I stand for the children, the spouses, and parents whose family made the ultimate sacrifice for us. We are all standing. We're the National Rifle Association of America, and we are freedom's safest place.
Thanks again for being a part of this edition of Cam and Company. Glad you have joined us today. Still to come, Laura Carno with Coloradans for Civil Liberties right now. I want to welcome to the program from the Center for Individual Freedom online at CFIF.org. Mr. Tim Lee is with us. Tim, how are you, sir?
Doing well, doing well. Congratulations, Cowboys, on the big win in Texas. Sorry for Texas fans that 2 weeks in a row you went down to teams from Oklahoma, but hey, at least Cam's happy.
I am happy. I was actually happy enough that I was looking online because Oklahoma State is visiting West Virginia, which mm-hmm. is the closest that that they'll be for a couple of years. And so I was actually online today looking up tickets and parking passes and you know, everything else that it cost. It's the cost of even going to a college football game, Tim. I mean, it's just absolutely absurd. But
There is a slight chance. I still have to talk it over with my wife this evening, but there is a slight chance that I will be in Morgantown, West Virginia this weekend for the Oklahoma State-West Virginia game.
Well, two mascots that carry firearms. Mountaineers, I think they still carry the musket, and the Oklahoma State Cowboy.
That's right, Pistol Pete. And, West Virginia University, they not only are they the Mountaineers, and I think you're right. I think he still has his musket. But West Virginia University rifle team, really, I mean, one of the best in the country. Jenny Thrasher, Olympic gold medalist, NCAA champion, and every year they just keep turning out world-class athletes. So they better not get rid of the musket on their mascot.
Say that almost makes you makes you want to root for them, right?
In everything but college football, yes, because Oklahoma State does not have a rifle team, unfortunately. I don't know why, but we don't. So, yes, I can and I do root for West Virginia and their rifle team. Now, I want to talk about what you have at CFI, of your latest column. Citizens United critics' predictions have fallen flat. We are, 7 years out from Citizens United. And you say critics of that decision were always wrong on the legal merits. Now, after nearly a decade and several election cycles to assess its impact, critics have proven equally inept in predicting the decision's practical effects. So first of all, Citizens United, this was the quote-unquote campaign finance reform case, right? What did the Supreme Court actually say in Citizens United, Tim?
Okay, so this was 2010, so almost a decade ago, and you know, we talked last week, and you and I talk often on your show about terms that just become popularized and they don't mean what people on the left hope they mean and whatnot. Citizens United is one of those. It was a case in which a nonprofit political organization, nonpartisan, but political organization speak. And when I say political, I mean they were speaking out about politics, which was kind of the point of the First Amendment when the founding fathers drafted and ratified it. All they wanted to do during the 2008 election was to air a short film critical of Hillary Clinton. So again, think about this. A film that is discussing a candidate for the nation's highest office, it's difficult to think of any type of speech that would be more protected by the First Amendment and by our founding fathers. Nevertheless, so-called campaign finance reform laws prohibited them from doing that, from even speaking out and airing this film before the election. And so they took it all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said no, that this group of people, even though they're a quote-unquote corporation, because that's how people gather together and create an organization, they have the right to pool their resources and speak. You know, you can't just say, well, it's only an individual right to the extent that a person can go to the town square and stand on a soapbox. So, of course, the outbreak of irrationality from the left was immediate. You know, the New York Times, in a very infamous editorial, said that now corporations were going to be able to buy elections. Barack Obama went before the nation and in his State of the Union speech, this is a former constitutional law professor, talked about how it was going to supposedly open the floodgates to foreign donations to political campaigns. Well, that was illegal then, and it's still illegal. Foreign people and foreign corporations can't contribute to politicians, to political parties, to election campaigns. So he just blatantly misstated the law and the holding. And a lot of people out there listening probably recall that sitting in the front row in that audience at the State of the Union address was Justice, among the others, Justice Samuel Alito. And he shook his head and said, that's not true. And, so that kind of created a stir as well. At any rate, the basic holding of Citizens United was that individual private citizens can come together, pool their resources, and speak out under First Amendment protections. So whenever you hear people on the left, and unfortunately some people on the right, people like John McCain have been terrible on First Amendment rights, whenever you hear Citizens United as they use it, They think it stands for this proposition that corporations can just go out and buy elections, and they say corporations don't have First Amendment rights. Well, think about that for a moment. If corporations don't have First Amendment rights, does that mean the government can go out and censor the New York Times or NBC News or MSNBC or CNN? I mean, after all, these are corporations. Sierra Club, that's a nonprofit corporation. You know, can they be silenced as well? So people who are critical of Citizens United need to think about the implications of what they're saying. At any rate, so that's the law of the matter. The First Amendment is very clear. Congress shall make no law restricting the freedom of speech. And as I point out in my column, that doesn't mean there aren't reasonable restrictions, just as, you know, the Second Amendment doesn't protect people owning nuclear weaponry. The Fourth Amendment doesn't require a warrant in all circumstances for police search and seizure. But what it does do is set a very high bar. If you're going to restrict other people's freedom of speech, you better have a very good reason, a compelling reason for doing so, and there must be no more limited way of restricting the speech to achieve that compelling end. So at any rate, Citizens United was sound on the law. It's sort of a tragedy of our current political discourse that Citizens United has come to stand for something that it's not. And then in my column, I point out that even if, setting aside the legal issues, the predictions of corporations just suddenly flooding our elections with money just haven't proven true. Among the top 40 donors to the 2016 political campaign, I think one of them was a business group. Tom Steyer, very left-wing environmental activist, was the number one contributor at $89 million. Labor unions, nonprofit organizations combined, they don't amount to what individuals donated. So they were wrong in their predictions as well.
Absolutely. Talking again with Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. And, you know, Tim, it's interesting because you know, look, when it comes to the gun control issue, for example, you've got a couple of, you mentioned Tom Steyer, but you've obviously got Michael Bloomberg, right, involved in the gun control issue, spent $50 million or so last year. He has already spent $1 million in Virginia this year and dropping another $700,000 at least just on the governor's race and the attorney general's race. You know, again, gun owners can't match Michael Bloomberg dollar for dollar. So, you know, if this were about pure partisan politics, you'd hear a lot of gun owners say, well, you know, yeah, we should have these limits. You know, Michael Bloomberg shouldn't be able to spend as much money as he wants. And yet I don't even hear a lot of gun owners make that argument. Let them spend their money. Right. And he's got plenty of money. Like we as gun owners are never going to be able to match him dollar for dollar. But that's not the only thing that matters in politics. As a matter of fact, there have been some studies that have come out recently showing campaign television ads don't really seem to be moving people as much. Phone calls don't seem to be moving people as much. I mean, there is, I think, a growing body of evidence that you can throw a ton of money at people, and it really doesn't guarantee you anything other than a certain number of people are going to get annoyed at hearing your message repeated ad nauseum.
That's true. And think about just the 2016 presidential election. Hillary Clinton outspent and outraised Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton also had, obviously, the enormous resources of the mainstream media behind her. And yet she lost, and in the Electoral College, by a substantial margin. So it obviously didn't guarantee that. You know, in between the years 2008 and, 2014, the Democrats controlled the Senate, and for a certain period there, the House as well. And so those incumbent Democrats outraised Republicans, but yet that didn't stop the Republicans from taking over as well. So, and before that, by the way, the Republicans had the incumbents and they were raising more, but the Democrats took over both houses of Congress in 2006. So you're right that there's simply not that direct correlation or one-to-one relationship between a dollar spent and political impact. You're right. In some ways, it might be the opposite. Some of those groups and politicians that are seen as being very powerful and backed by all that money, it actually kind of has a blowback effect in many cases as well, with populism rising both here and in Europe and elsewhere across the world. So you're absolutely right in that regard.
Tim Lee, listen, buddy, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is always good talking with you, and best of luck to your teams this weekend.
Well, USC and ASU play this week, so it's the two alma maters matching up. I wear maroon and gold, and I win either way, right?
Exactly. You're guaranteed a victory. All right, buddy. Have a great week. We'll talk to you soon.
You too. Thank you.
You bet. Tim Lee joining us here on Cam and Company. Laura Carno going to join us on the program. Second Amendment advocate out in Colorado talking about next year's governor's race. Yeah, we're still a year away in Colorado and most other states that will be having gubernatorial elections. Only New Jersey and Virginia have their governor's elections this year. And already a year out from Election Day 2018, gun control and the 2013 gun control laws put on the books in Colorado are becoming a campaign issue. We'll talk about it with Laura right after this. So stick around. There's more Cam and Company on the way.
We're back here at the 2017 NRA Carry Guard Expo in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm with Logan Medes. He is a firearm specialist for the NRA Museums. Logan, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So tell folks, why is someone from the NRA National Firearms Museum or the museums here at the Carry Guard Expo? What are you doing here?
Yeah, it seems a little weird, right? But it all makes sense. There's a method to the madness. We're here with a display. It's the history of concealed carry. So it's concealed carry over the centuries. And so we start real early. You know, the previous episode, we did that ball butt dag from 1675.
Right.
You know, and then we're going to move through history. A little out of order in terms of ignition systems with what we're going to see today. But it's all part of the evolution of concealed carry. You don't get today's modern pocket pistol unless you have the stuff that came before it. And so we're going through that time chronology with the designs of concealed carry.
So what we did, Logan, with you being here and me being here, of course I thought, well, let's do some curator's corners.
Absolutely.
So here we are. So what do we have to look at in this segment?
So this is cute. This is a...
Is it appropriate to say cute about a gun? I guess it is.
I think it is.
Okay, you know? Well, go ahead.
So this is Derringer's Derringer. Now, we've all heard of, you know, the little pocket pistols, little Derringers, right? Now, that's Derringer with two R's.
Right.
But a Derringer with one R. So the man who made it, Henry Derringer. This is an actual Henry Derringer Derringer. So that's why I'm calling it Derringer's Derringer. And the cuteness comes in because of the size. This was called the baby or peanut size. Little bitty guy. Yeah, little bitty guy. 41 caliber, single shot, made in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh, Philly.
Yeah, around 1850 or so. But very, very cute little gun. Perfect design to stick into your pocket. Perfect for concealed carry at that time period.
Shows how it operates.
So it's a percussion gun. And so you'd bring the hammer back. You put your percussion cap onto the cone. And then you pull the trigger and everything goes boom and foof and out the end.
Right. So let's talk about ignition systems in the German ball butt dag. Mm-hmm. And this percussion's a significant change of an ignition system. Am I correct? Tell us the difference.
So you start with matchlock and then to wheel lock. Then we get flintlock designs. And then beyond flintlock, you end up with percussion designs. And so the percussion system is actually invented in the early 1800s by a Scottish reverend. His name was Forsyth. So a man of the cloth came up with the percussion system. A lot easier to use than a flintlock design. It's faster to reload, easier to handle. And it made concealed carry, yet again, even easier as the ignition systems go on.
Because I know a lot of times with flints, you'd have issues with it igniting, and it could be very tricky and very cumbersome and quite dangerous.
Definitely, because you've got that big flash in the pan. That's where that term comes from. And then, of course, that's right up by your face if you're dealing with a long gun. It's definitely much safer to use something this size, and it fits really easily into your pocket.
Yeah, it sure does. And it's beautiful, woodwork and everything on it.
Yeah, there's wonderful checkering on it. There's engraving onto the tang of the barrel. There's actual gold bands at the breech of the barrel here.
Wow.
So it may be diminutive in size, but not in character.
Yeah. And what's the projectile? What's
it's a round shot, a round lead ball, 41 caliber. And they're very effective. A firearm just like this size, is what was used to assassinate our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln.
Wow. So it got the job done back in the day.
It got the job done.
Wow. Okay, so how can we see this firearm and other ones like it?
If you can't visit us in person, NRAMuseums.com, a bunch of social media channels, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. We got you covered one way or the other.
We started with the German butt dag, and we're going all the way through. That was like 1675, right?
Yep.
We're going to go all the way through what?
Well, we're going to get into the very early 20th century. So we're going to run about three and a quarter centuries worth of stuff.
That's all coming up. So. Special series. This is segment 2 of 6 of, we're calling this Concealed Carry on Curator's Corner.
Yeah,
so,
I love
Carry
it.
Guard. A lot of C's there.
Yeah,
so.
A lot of C's.
All right. And we'll see you for the next edition of Curator's Corner.
Thanks very much.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. All right, we've got 2 weeks from tomorrow, elections in Virginia and New Jersey, but coming up in about a year, there are going to be a lot of other states taking a look at who they will pick as governor. Colorado, already 9 declared candidates. Here to talk about this, Laura Carno, lauracarno.com. Laura, how are you today?
Hi, I'm really good. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. So, yeah, 9 declared candidates for governor in Colorado. Holy moly. And one of the papers there in Colorado talking about how the 2013 gun control laws already an issue for these candidates and expected to be an issue in the 2018 governor's race. This was the Journal Advocate newspaper. And it's interesting. They say that in the 4 years since Colorado took the twin steps of expanding background checks to private sales, limiting the size of magazines to 15 rounds, there remains a deep divide over beliefs and their effectiveness, with state statistics in one recent study suggesting the efforts have had a limited impact. All right, so if the statistics don't really show that it's working, then what are the gun control advocates clinging to in their belief that that these laws are effective and maybe even need to be expanded, Laura?
Yeah, and that's the right question to be asking. There's one statistic that said that between 2016 and 2017, Denver is actually averaging one murder a month more in 17 than 16. So, you know, we're practical people out here in the Mountain West, and I like to look at things that work. And they promised in 2013. We didn't believe them, but they promised in 2013 that their gun control laws would make us safer. They did not. Not a big surprise here. But what's interesting is you've got obviously a divide between the Democrats and the Republicans on whether they should we should keep the 2013 laws or repeal them. But one Democrat, Michael Johnston, went so far as to say, if he's elected governor, he would push to pass the 15-round magazine limitation nationally. He's so proud of that.
Nationally, really? I'm curious. I think one of the litmus tests. I mean, if this is for the anti-gun politicians, anyway. You know, California has declared that not only is there a limit, no magazines over 10 rounds. That's been in effect since 1998. You couldn't sell or manufacture or buy these magazines, but you could still own them. Now they've got a law that says now you can't even own them anymore. You got to turn them in. Do you anticipate that any of the Democrats, any of the anti-gun candidates running for governor in Colorado would actually say, let's double down. Let's have, Gunmageddon 2 here. And these magazines that we banned you from buying, we know a lot of you still have them there in Colorado, and we're going to make it illegal for you to simply possess the magazines that you already own.
I'm not seeing any indication yet, but if they would like to go there, let's go there. I don't have any problem with our Republican nominee going up against somebody who says, let's go knock on doors and take magazines. I think that'll go over really well in Colorado.
Well, look, I mean, but okay. So here's the next question. If they're not talking about that, then the question I think becomes, okay, so in California, this was the next step. You're not advocating this now. Would you advocate this in the future? And if not, why is it wrong for California to now ban the possession of these magazines that you are in favor of people being able to buy,
right? I think there's a logical inconsistency there. Like, I think the whole magazine ban thing is barking up the wrong tree, but at least California is kind of taking it to its logical end, right? If they've already banned the possession, the manufacture, the sale, why can't you tell people that have legally owned these magazines for 18 years? Well, now you're a criminal if you keep them. There's some perverse logical consistency, at least to that position.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. One, we're no strangers to logical inconsistencies. If you'll remember in 2013, when our gun bills were going through and Governor Hickenlooper said, oh, those magazines over 15 rounds are so awful. But hey, Magpul, if you want to stay in Colorado and send them to other states, knock yourself out. So there was that logical inconsistency.
Mm-hmm.
And
go ahead.
And so I was just going to say, what it looks like the Democrats are doing now is taking a defensive posture. So the Everytown representative for Colorado said, well, we just don't want them repealed. So it does, and maybe they're still feeling the sting from the recalls in 2013, that they'd better not speak out in favor of more gun control. And as we've talked about on this show, we don't have any Democrat state legislators here saying, man, those gun control bills in 2013 were awesome. I'm going to run on that record. They're just not even talking about it. So it has a very different feel here, I think, because they, as they understand the Colorado electorate, we're not that interested in more gun control.
Well, and, you know, particularly, I mean, I'm looking at a couple of these statistics here in this news story. So in the 4 years that this magazine limit has been in effect, Colorado authorities, the paper says, have filed charges less than 60 times. And there have only been two convictions in the last 40 years. So yeah, less than 60 times charges have been filed. And in the vast, vast majority of those cases, those charges were dropped. You have two convictions in 4 years. And, you know, go back to the debate over this, Laura. I mean, we were told, you were told, not only are you an awful person for objecting to this law, but that, you know, this law was going to save lives. This was going to be a meaningful piece of legislation that would impact Coloradans. And now you've got two convictions of this law in 4 years.
Right. And those convictions, by the way, weren't, this person has 16-round mags and we're going to get him. It was somebody who was arrested for huge other crimes and just happened to have something more than 15 rounds on them. And so they tacked it on to whatever other horrible things this person had done. And what's interesting among even the Republican candidates, there are some different viewpoints on these laws. One gubernatorial candidate, George Brockler, the DA who prosecuted the Aurora theater killer, he said he would never go after a law-abiding citizen whose only crime, so to speak, is having a magazine more than 15 rounds. Not everybody is as clear on that, but at least some of the Republicans are being very clear.
Yeah, well, and okay, so speaking of muddled messages here, Jared Polis, current Congress member, running for a governor. The Journal Advocate asked him about a proposed ban on quote-unquote assault weapons, specifically saying that Senator Feinstein had introduced a bill in 2013 which would have banned dozens of firearms and other, quote, large ammunition feeding devices. Polis at the time skeptical of the bill, saying it could interfere with recreation and, quote, make it harder for Colorado families to defend themselves. Asked whether he would support a similar measure in Colorado, Polis did not provide a yes or no answer. Quote, we shouldn't ban guns that are popular among hunters and sportsmen, but weapons of war are too dangerous and serve no legitimate sporting purpose. So I guess you're supposed to be able to read into that whatever you want, right? If you want a gun ban, well, he said that these weapons of war shouldn't be available. If you want to believe that he doesn't support a gun ban, well, we shouldn't ban guns that are popular among hunters and sportsmen. I got to tell you, Laura, I don't know how long Jared Polis is going to be able to get away with a mealy-mouthed statement like that.
Right. And so what you're hearing is a politician who's running for governor in a state that the congressional district he's in is very, very liberal. He has proposed that as governor, Colorado will be completely energy independent or fossil fuel independent, just renewables by 2040, 100% renewables. So there's that. He has that to say. But he also knows that he lives in a state that recalled 2.5 state senators over their gun control votes, and he has to win the entire state, not just Boulder. So what you hear there is political speak. And by the way, he's the multimillionaire who's going to put in, he said, money's no object. He'll do whatever it takes to win. So he's going to be the one putting a lot of money in. And I would love it if he were the Democrat nominee, because I think that some of these things that you're talking about will make whoever wins on the Republican side look like the absolute most practical person in the race.
Interesting. Talking again with Laura Carno, Second Amendment advocate in Colorado. You can find her on Twitter at Laura Carno, lauracarno.com. Eileen McCarron with Colorado Ceasefire, the anti-gun group, said that she has seen a shift among state Democrats on the issue of gun control, or maybe even more specifically, a ban on semi-automatic firearms. She said the changing demographics of the state, the shootings in Aurora and in Newtown, she said those two events were crystallizing for a lot of people in the state of Colorado. You know, she says she's seen a shift among state Democrats, Laura, not necessarily among the electorate, and not necessarily among the state at large. I'm wondering if it's possible that, yes, she has seen a shift within the Democratic Party, that maybe the Democratic Party has become more anti-gun, while at the same time, the electorate at large in Colorado has not shifted the way some of these candidates and politicians have.
Right. And so I'm betting that she is looking at Democrat politicians who are currently engaged in primaries. Because of course it's just like in the presidential primary, they're going to out gun control the other one. But mm-hmm. It's also interesting. I thought in her statement where she said changing demographics and then these crimes that have been committed, Newtown and Las Vegas. So I never look at demographics and say, oh, they're changing, so we should have more gun rights. No, we always should have more gun rights. I don't think that any shift in demographics means that we should tighten down any sort of law. You have rights or you don't have rights. And the other thing, and this gets brought up so frequently, is there are crimes committed by bad guys. So let's punish all the people who didn't commit the crime. I think, you know, gun rights advocates absolutely see through that, but I don't think she has a leg to stand on there.
Interesting. So do you agree? I mean, do you think that these 2013 gun laws, are they going to be a big issue in 2018 in Colorado?
Yeah. And I hope that the Republicans make them a big deal. I said that there was a little bit of difference. You know, obviously, the Republicans are mostly pro-gun, but there is some, I think, misunderstanding among some of the less experienced candidates in the race. Who say that they're in favor of the background checks that passed in 2013. And I don't know if they just don't know that we've always had NICS checks, but what passed in 2013 made it illegal for example, a friend of mine was deployed and she asked me to keep her handgun while she was gone. So her handing that over to me for safekeeping without first going to an FFL, would have made me a criminal. And I don't think everybody knows just what happened in 2013. So I think that'll all have to shake out on the Republican side. But there's definitely a clear divide between the two parties.
Absolutely. And, you know, we did see that study, I think it was last week, by Garen Wintemute at UC Davis, taking a look at the effectiveness of these quote-unquote universal background check laws in Washington State, Colorado, and Delaware, found no appreciable increase in the number of background checks that were performed in Colorado. And so, you know, again, I'm with you. I hope that we do see folks make this an issue and remind people, you know, listen, when they tell you that these are incredibly important life-saving tools, they're wrong. And if you want to reduce violent crime, there are ways to go about it that don't involve going after legal law-abiding gun owners, because they can't point to any success here. They can't point to any success with this magazine ban. So why on earth would you keep listening to them when they say, well, it's going to be the next gun law that's going to make a difference?
Right, exactly. And I think in 2013, we did a really good job in Colorado of communicating with ordinary Colorado citizens for whom gun bills or gun control or gun rights isn't even interesting to them. I think we did a really good job communicating with them, and we've got some track record here. You know, you've got Victor Head in Pueblo, the plumber who recalled Senator Angela Jaron, a normal, ordinary, average guy who communicated beautifully with the voters. We did that same thing here in Colorado Springs, telling Senator Morse, don't you dare tell me how to defend myself. And then you've also got Kimberly Corbin, a rape survivor, who's saying, don't disarm me. Don't disarm other women who could protect themselves from having to go through that same awful thing I did. So I think we've got some good communicators here in the state, and if they want to make it, they want to make gun control an issue, I think we'll be happy to take that on again.
Laura, listen, we are unfortunately out of time, but I appreciate you coming on the show today. It's great talking with you, and I imagine we'll be talking a lot about Colorado politics between now and Election Day next year.
Good seeing you. Thank you.
All right, Laura Carno with us here on Cam & Company. That music means we got a scoot. We will see you tomorrow live, 2 p.m. Eastern on NRA TV, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific on SiriusXM Patriot 125, on demand all the time, iHeartRadio, iTunes as well.